72005. This is the Emergency Board Human Services Subcommittee, and we welcome you all today. And we'll begin with the block of consents relating to federal grants. Mr. Warden.
Thank you, Chair Richardson and members of the subcommittee. The consent agenda for federal grant approval consists of three agencies seeking approval for three grants. Two of the requests are for retroactive approval, for which both agencies provided timely notice to legislative leadership. They are items number 22, Economic and Community Development Department, approve the submission of a federal grant application to the U.S. EPA for brownfields assessment to assist Oregon ports with redevelopment of port-owned or operated properties. Item number 26, the Department of Forestry, approve retroactively the submission of a federal grant application to the U.S. Department of Homeland Security for fire prevention and safety grants. Item number 30, Department of State Lands, approve retroactively the submission of a federal National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration grant application to explore the potential of restoring self-sustaining populations of native Olympic oysters in the South Slough Estuary. Chair Richardson, members of the subcommittee, the Legislative Fiscal Office recommends approval in block of the three grant applications with the understanding that if the funds are awarded, the agencies will return to the Emergency Board or Legislative Assembly for approval of any necessary federal grant or federal funds expenditure limitation and position authority.
Hello. Are there questions of Mr. Borden relating to the applications for federal grants? If not, Chair would accept the motion. Representative Pena.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd move to approve the grant applications as described to Foley Board.
Okay, Representative Hanna moves that the applications for federal grants be accepted, or that we move this to the full e-board with a recommendation that they be accepted. Is there discussion?
No discussion, but just a comment. I would hope that even though it's just an application process and we're moving them in block and they can come back if their positions and or if they receive approval from the feds, it would be nice to have information in a more timely manner so that you can vet this and review it enough to where you're intelligent enough to make certain that you're making the right decision. I will give an aye vote, but for me, I think it's important that we receive some of this information in a more timely fashion.
Yes. So noted. Is there objection to the motion? Hearing none, motion carries. Mr. Borden, we now will go to agency reports.
Thank you, Chair Richardson, the subcommittee. The consent report agenda consists of four reports from five agencies. Item number four, Department of Transportation, acknowledge receipt of a report on real-time access to driving records. Item number 18, Military Department, acknowledge receipt of a report on the National Guard's response to Hurricanes Katrina and Rita. Item number 24, Department of Land Conservation and Development and Department of Administrative Services, acknowledge receipt of a report on the implementation of ballot measure 37. Item number 27, Department of Forestry, acknowledge receipt of a report on the 2005 fire season and the department's use of severity resources. The Legislative Fiscal Office recommends acknowledging receipt in block of the four agency reports.
Is there questions for our LFO analyst? Then the Chair would accept the motion.
I move to accept the agency reports.
Senator Winters moves to accept the agency reports and move them to full e-board. Is there objection? Hearing none, motion carries. I need carriers for this. On the federal grants, Representative Hannon.
Thank you.
And then for full board, Senator Winters, would you carry that? Okay, now we'll move to agency requests. We'll begin with item 10 on our agenda, on the overall agenda, which is Department of Human Services and Department of Justice, representation of child welfare caseworkers. If representatives from DOJ and DHS come forward.
Good morning. Thank you.
Good morning.
Morning, Mr. Chair.
Welcome you.
Thank you.
If you could go ahead and fill us in
good
on
morning.
What the proposal is and how it's different from the recommendation that was made to the subcommittee during the course. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Chair Richardson, members of the subcommittee. For the record, I'm Hardy Myers, Attorney General. We appreciate this opportunity to present briefly to you on this very important proposal for enhanced legal representation in child dependency cases. I'm joined by Clyde Johnston, who is the interim director of the Department of Human Services. I'll speak briefly for the Department of Justice, if I may, Mr. Chair, and then he'll follow for the Department of Human Services. We have also presented to you, in addition to the testimony, we're going to provide certain written materials, and in the interest of time, we want to discuss briefly the need for the appropriation, how the departments plan to implement the proposal if adopted, and finally, our best thoughts on performance measures and how the legislature and the people, for that matter, can judge whether these resources, if approved, were a prudent investment and are responding to a need that's really quite critical. The request, Mr. Chair, members, is really about a decade in the making. In 1997, both the Assembly and Congress enacted new laws that dramatically altered the practices of the Department of Human Services when they remove a child from the child's home. And the history of the law change and the overview of that total process under current law is set out in the written materials that we provide the subcommittee. And one product of the law change was a dramatic increase in the number of court hearings required before the implementation of a permanency plan for a given child. In some cases, there may be six or more hearings over the course of a year. And last year, in 2004, the state was a party in over 25,000 separate hearings. At the same time, there has been no real concurrent increase in the availability of legal resources to assist in these child welfare cases. And consequently, human services, caseworkers, and managers have been forced to shift a significant portion of their resources toward the completion of complex legal tasks. The Department of Justice provides legal assistance at this time only in the very most complex cases. And the shortfall in available legal resources results in delays in the permanency process. Caseworkers have to balance their critical social services responsibilities with the execution of unfamiliar legal requirements. And our proposal today will help free caseworkers to focus on development of plans to better and more quickly achieve a safe and permanent living situation for children, whether that's return to their own homes or some other arrangement.
Okay, may I just kind of go to the conclusion, the areas that I'd like to have us focus on. The policy package 104 that was originally proposed had quite a lot larger fiscal and was going to create a substantial increase in the number of attorneys for DOJ, and in the opinion of the committee, we felt that it was likely to actually just be the first step in a much larger bureaucracy that was going to be growing, because with the investment, we were going to increase the attendance by DOJ attorneys from 5% to 15%, but the recommendation from at least one of the DHS leaders was that we really ought to have between 50 and 75% attendance, you know, at various hearings. And so that would have, we just did the math, and it came out to like $50 to $60 million if we had enough attorneys to do what ultimately was desired. And so it looked like we were just putting the camel under the edge of the tent, and that it was just going to continue. Now, what is being proposed here is fewer attorneys, no caseworkers from DHS being transferred from casework position to paralegal or assistant kind of positions. It seems to be carved back substantially, but is the goal to just do less than the 15%, or is there a change in the way that we're going to be approaching this so that this isn't merely just a step in the right direction but a smaller step?
Chair Richardson, the package is contracted on the DOJ side, first of all, to 10 positions, including 5 lawyers. all caseworkers of DHS are preserved in this package. That was a point of concern as well. And in the planning of the new proposal for the e-board, the agencies have constructed for the first time criteria which are set out in the written materials we provide for you that will guide DHS in determining whether legal services will be requested or not. And as to the highest priority cases set out in the criteria, this package is intended to provide 100% coverage of those most important and critical cases. So, and there is a, there will be, I think, an increased effort toward legal consultation and advice, and a reduction, I think, in the anticipated amount of time that would be spent within the new resources on litigation and hearings. We hope that we expect that the increase of the availability of consultative help will substantially increase the number of cases in which settlements occur, and there is obviated the need for recurrent hearings and disagreement before a final permanency plan is issued.
Okay, if I could direct your attention to the categorization, you have there's proposed three areas, and one is those areas of kinds of cases that automatically will be will be conveyed to DOJ, either paralegals or attorneys, and they deal with, I'm looking at page 3 of the materials, transition plans, visitation, intervention, reasonable effort issues, and complex certification, licensing, and adoption issues. And it says that in any of those paragraphs, let's see.
In the letter on page 2.
I'm looking for, okay, I'm sorry. If we can go to, we'll be on the same page. I'm looking for those items that will require DOJ involvement. And
they are in the, Mr. Chair, they're in the letter to the AE board on page 2 and also on page 6 of the package of materials that we supplied.
That's an addendum to page 6.
All right, let me go to page 6 of what was just handed to us then. And see where we're at there. Okay. So we have cases receiving review in every instance. All right. Law and policy disagreements, preventing expeditious case resolution, implementation of a permanency plan, review, permanency hearings, and certification of licensing actions. These would require DOJ involvement, correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Then the next level was transition plans, visitation, intervention, reasonable effort issues, complex certifications, licensing, and adoption issues. Is that correct? Are those the ones that would be possibly?
And there are still others in that grouping, Chair Richardson.
Okay. Also, in the ones I want to focus on are the others, which were court orders, agency authority, misconduct, or alleged liability, which could result in the state being sued, and Department of Human Services records or information. And this would involve when there's a court order, a subpoena, a request for disclosure, or when DHS is unable to determine whether or not it would be appropriate to testify. My question is, why would something as important as allegations of agency misconduct and potential lawsuits be something where the DHS caseworkers might or might not refer that to DOJ, when it seems to me like those certainly ought to go to DOJ because the state's at risk? Or there's also an internal kind of a conflict of interest. If there's allegations of misconduct, it would seem like that would be an appropriate thing for DOJ to kind of take a look at. What do you think?
I understand, Church. May I ask Larry Young of our Human Services section to join us, because he was really the principal DOJ representative in the dialogue between the two agencies that resulted in these categories or priorities.
Chairman Richardson, members of the committee, my name is Larry Young. I'm an assistant attorney general. Question is, why would these not be 100% referral items? Initially, the problem is that there are a number of cases that could involve very sensitive issues. And if there were 100% of those cases to come to the Department of Justice, Every case is potentially sensitive, and people cannot see into the future as to how sensitive or how dangerous they may be with respect to possible tort liability for the state agency. Typically what happens is we find out about it after something bad has happened, and 100% of those cases do come to us. But we're trying to put the emphasis on preventative legal advice in this package, and many, many situations in child welfare cases can be potentially very serious, can potentially involve tort liability for the state. It's just a fact that the caseworkers have to live with day in and day out. And so the question is, when is it more sensitive or more dangerous? And those are the cases that they should come to us on.
How would you define potential agency misconduct?
Chairman Richardson, caseworkers have various duties assigned pursuant to their position announcement and plans, but occasionally they don't always do what they should do. Occasionally it's because of intentional misconduct. Occasionally it's because of inadvertence. They are very, very much overworked, and sometimes they do not see information on a timely basis or do not appreciate the information that they are seeing. We try and get around that. Hopefully that does not happen very often, but it does occasionally happen. It's human error.
How about alleged agency liability? I mean, why would that not be something that DOJ ought to take a look at if they're representing, if you're a business and somebody is saying that you've had misconduct and we're going to sue you and you have legal counsel? Normally you would ask them, for one thing, that there's often litigation can be avoided by taking action or talking to people or trying to placate things or work things out before it goes into formal litigation. And so I'm just trying to decide, why would that not be appropriate for that to be a required DOJ evaluation?
Chair Richardson, the problem is that the child welfare dependency litigation arena is extraordinarily contentious, and people raise all sorts of allegations all the time, which can involve agency liability. Caseworkers and their supervisors and management at DHS are skilled in analyzing those kinds of threats and determining whether or not there is, in fact, potential problems with the agency's conduct in a particular case, or there may be potential problems with potential conduct in a case. And then if they think that there is a significant problem, they do refer it to us. So when they go through an analysis process, but I mean, we are talking thousands and thousands of cases with 25,000 hearings a year. I mean, people say all sorts of things in those hearings.
So what I hear you say is that this recommendation really is focused on caseworker assistance, not on other aspects where DOJ may be involved. It could be expanded, but from what you're saying, though, that it could end up costing a lot of time, and therefore it would be beyond the scope of what's being recommended, and so we really ought not to go there at this stage. Is that basically what?
I'm saying that the agency staff have to use judgment to decide whether or not it's important enough to involve the Attorney General, given that there are limited resources available for them.
Okay. All right. Thank you. That clarifies that for me, and I can see that it could be much more complicated.
Just to add to that, because I think also following that line is that most of the cases that come into child welfare where you is contentious. And so because that climate exists in the beginning, if you took every one of those cases, then you would we would request that they all fall under the legal purview of the AG's office, the cost would be astronomical. Mm-hmm. Caseworkers are trained to understand these conflicts that they're having to deal with, and so that potential, and it's correct, is there with every with the majority of the cases that you see in child welfare.
Mm-hmm. You've answered my questions, and I appreciate that. If it's okay, I'd just like to see if there's other questions that the panel has, because if not, then there's no sense in reviewing what we've read. Representative Hannah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My questions actually relate more to the performance or how we will finally know that this plan is working, and so probably more so from the DHS measurement side, but a number of places in the material that we've been provided, this proposal is expected to increase the time DHS caseworkers can spend on casework, improve the quality of services for children and families, resolve cases more quickly, put caseworkers face to face with those customers, children, and families that they have than they have had because they've taken their time performing these legal duties. And I've reviewed the performance measures that go along with this package, but I don't really see how we're measuring that part of it. Now, we do talk about reviewing that, but how are we going to measure that? When you come back to talk to us, how will they be measured against those criteria?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanna, for the record, my name is Brian Johnston. I'm the interim director of the department. We currently have two existing performance measures that we think will show a numerical improvement based upon the passage and the implementation of this proposal. Number one would be the median number of months from date of latest removal from home to finalized adoption. And number two would be the percentage of abused, neglected children who were re-abused within 6 months of prior victimization. So we should be able to take a look at those on a quantifiable comparison basis and make a determination as to whether those two situations are better or worse or remain the same. We think that there are also, in the written materials, we've highlighted five specific areas in which improved performance will result in positive overall gains. Namely, in cases in which reunification is the goal, it will occur more rapidly. In cases in which adoption is the goal, it will occur more frequently and more rapidly. And fewer children will reenter foster care, and a smaller number of cases in which children are placed in another planned permanent living arrangement. So I think we've got five total numerically quantifiable measures that we can determine whether or not we have improved on these measures or not. And it won't be a question of subjectivity as much as math.
A follow-up, please.
I don't want to get this wrong or misquote this, but in one of our previous hearings during the session, we heard at one point that caseworkers spend as much as 85 or 90% of their time on paperwork rather than meeting with clients. Can you comment to that? I mean, how much more time are we going to put them
with
the client?
Well, I can tell you this, Representative, that we're going to take these 20 paralegals and spread them about the state and put them into offices. And in each office that they go, there will be a direct reduction in the types of paperwork that is preparation for the legal matters. So while I don't know, although Ramona Foley is here and may know exactly the proportions to which you have referenced, I can tell you as a one-time practicing attorney that removing the questions of the organization of documents, the collection of witness statements, the delineation of witness statements to present the compelling, substantially legally adequate case, you know, from the workload of a caseworker will give him or her the opportunity to perform their actual duties.
And just briefly, one more follow-up. And to my point, simply, I hope we can quantify that by adding the paralegals, by taking that work away from them, that those caseworkers will spend more time with the folks that they need to be out with in the field, those families and children seeking their service rather than providing the legal work. I just want to know that we can quantify it some way when we're done.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanna, that is a management result that we should be able to track.
Right.
Attorney General Myers, maybe you could clarify one thing for me. We have an assignment of staff, and we have five attorneys. One attorney is going to Portland, and two legal secretaries are going to Portland. Four attorneys are going to Eugene, and one legal secretary is going to Eugene. Is the one going to Portland just kind of so productive that he needs two secretaries, or maybe how does that work?
May I invite my colleague to come back, Mr. Chair?
Chair Richardson, I would hope I could find an attorney that is that productive. The reason is that there are other attorneys in the Portland office that currently do child welfare work, and we currently have approximately half an FTE assigned, a legal secretary assigned to them, and that inhibits their ability to perform as productively as we would like. If they have an additional legal secretary, they will be able to move the paperwork that an attorney has to move and prepare for hearings and do settlement negotiations and agreements. in a more productive and expeditious manner.
Okay, well, that's good to know. Thank you very much. Other questions for this panel before we...
I just would like to know the basis of how you made the decision of distribution of the attorneys for Portland and Eugene and the Valley.
I'll ask Mr. Young to come back up to supplement this if necessary, but... sorry. Since Chair Richardson, Senator Winters, the...
How well her cases seem to be in the Valley.
The basic decisions with respect to location are really, I think, intended to provide us with the ability to serve the largest number of cases we can with the additional resources. And these particular placements provide us, give us access to about 72 to 75% of all the cases will be within 45 miles of a DOJ office. That's the kind of additional convenience for service we'll be able to provide, and I think that, simply put, the decision for the placement of these additional resources is driven by a desire to access the largest number of cases as conveniently as we can.
You know, as we move ahead with technology, it's there's no reason why we couldn't really get into the 21st century, assuming that we can get the finances to do it, where your attorneys can use real-time audiovisual and those kinds of things. You don't have to drive 3 hours or 4 hours to Lakeview to be able to talk to someone with the technology we have, and it just doesn't make a whole lot of sense to use such a finite resource as the attorney time to travel all over when we have the capability now that we didn't have even 10 years ago, and we end up doing work like we did it 20 years ago or 100 years ago. And I'm really looking forward to the time when, in many areas of our state government, we can transition and utilize the efficiencies that are available that will save a lot of time and money and increase our efficiency.
Chair Richardson, we are, of course, making headway in that area already with regard to, for example, hearings within the corrections system, mm-hmm. where attorneys will be in Salem but participating in a hearing at, for example, the Snake River Correctional Institute.
Okay.
Chair Richardson, I'd like to add that we have been using the video conferencing and telephone conferencing capabilities made possible by electronic systems for years, especially in the Portland office for the Eastern Oregon counties, everything along the I-4 corridor. Most of the courts actually have the video conferencing capability within the court, and they're familiar with it, and we use it. We also use it fairly extensively in Southern Oregon and Southern Coast areas, because those are the areas where you have to travel the most. The problem with video conferencing is you're not there in the courtroom. If there are documents that are being handled, if you haven't gotten them to the courtroom in advance, that's a problem. If the other side produces documents that they haven't gotten to you, that's a problem. So we use that technology whenever it's possible. At a short or simple hearing, judges have shown themselves perfectly willing for us to do that. But if it's a significant hearing, we pretty much
certainly makes sense.
Mr. Chair, can I ask
Senator
Wendell? In putting your packet together, did you consider, and looking at the need, where we're becoming a lot more aggressive in the whole issue of methamphetamine and going in, and so in that process, we're also seeing more children that are needing not only foster care and shelter care and temporary homes, but also I suspect that there will be also some of those children who will also be a part of the permanency hearing and the court process. When you put these this package together, were those factors considered?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, they were considered, and the division was by workload. For example, in our 16 service delivery areas, the largest number of paralegals will go to Multnomah County, that's 4. The second largest will go to the Marion Polk service delivery area, 3, that's 3. And it's divided by those awarenesses of workload.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Gordley.
Thank you very much, and good morning. I would like to go back to the criteria for legal review and consultation, and I'd like to gain a better understanding of how, looking at that piece around agency authority, misconduct, or alleged liability, would you say more, please, about what the training looks like that helps the workers supervisors, helps them identify properly elements that might be involved in screening for these cases. What does the training look like?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, with permission, I'd like Ramona Foley to help address that question for you.
Certainly. Good morning, Ms. Foley.
Good morning. For the record, I'm Ramona Foley. I'm Assistant Director with the Department of Human Services, Children, Adults, and Families. Chair Richardson is Ms. Gordley. In response to your question, workers go through core training, and during that core training, which is provided by Portland State University, in going through that core training, they are trained to what those issues are that have legal implications in doing casework. They're sensitized to time frames around going to court, around the kinds of documentation that have to be provided to court. And so this particular type of consultation will be for a case where there's some question around the caseworker's responsibility or the caseworker's authority. The caseworker may find they're being challenged by an attorney from another party in a case. And in a case such as that, they may want to have a phone consultation around their case to see, is this an issue where the question about DHS authority is a legitimate concern?
Okay. And the training that you are referencing, Ms. Foley, this training is mandatory and made available to every caseworker, every supervisor who might be involved in making a decision about whether a case rises to this level of concern or not.
Chairman Anderson and Senator Gordon, what will be additional is that the training and the kinds of consultation criteria you see here, we will be training the paralegals on those particular kinds of issues. So you have the mandatory training that's currently provided for all casework staff and training for supervisors, and then in addition, there'll be training around what does this criteria mean as I apply it. And that criteria and that training will be a joint effort between the Department of Justice and DHS, but it will include the new attorneys and it would also include the paralegals.
And so that training, again, just to clarify, the training, that part of the training does not include Portland State University. The PSU training is something else.
Chair Richardson and Senator Gordley, the Portland State University training is already ongoing mandatory training. This will become mandatory training, but this will be also for paralegals as they work with the attorneys from the Department of Justice.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Are there other questions? If there's not, then we could invite our BAM analyst to come back. And I said BAM. Very careful. Welcome. Let's see. I'll go ahead and give your report.
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, I am Sam Tetra from the Department of Administrative Services, and we recommend that you approve this request.
Okay. Our local analyst, Sheila Baker.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, we also recommend you approve the request. I would just like to clarify for the record the different funding pieces. The allocation of the special appropriation to the emergency board would be made to Department of Human Services, at least almost all of it, $2,497,924 out of the $2.5 million special purpose appropriation. The department is able to match that with federal funds, and then of that amount, part of it gets paid to Department of Justice for the attorney costs and the other DOJ staffing costs. So the total package cost is a little under $5 million, but it needs to be both a part of the DHS budget and then the part that's paid out for DOJ. DOJ needs expenditure limitation for as well. And so in some sense, you're double counting costs, as we typically do with DOJ expenditures. But the cost of the package overall is about the $4.6, $4.7 million, even though budgetarily you will be making adjustments to the budgets that exceed that amount.
Questions for analysts?
Yes. With regard to the training issues just discussed. Is there a way of separating out from the funding that will be made available how much is being allocated for training specifically?
Mr. Chair and Senator Gordley, I don't have that amount. I can ask the agencies to provide that.
I would be interested in looking at that piece separate from the positions.
Mm-hmm.
What does the training component look like, and are we providing enough capacity to provide for that adequate training to get people where we want them to be?
Would you feel comfortable proceeding with the with this issue and sending it to the e-board with the understanding that we'll get that information later?
Absolutely. Yes.
All right. There's no other questions for our analysts, then actually we could take a motion. Senator Gordley, do you want to
move? So moved.
Okay. Senator Gordley moves that the LFO recommendation on item 10 of our agenda be accepted and moved to full board, to full e-board with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Is there objection? Hearing none. So approved. Thank you very much. And Senator Gordley, would you carry that?
Happy to. Yes. Okay.
All right. We'll now move to item number 11, Department of Human Services, 2003-05 budget closeout. I almost said fiasco, but I chose not.
Mr. Chair, thank you for your discretion. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Brian Johnston, and I'm the acting interim director of the Department of Human Services. What you have in front of you is what is referred to in a variety of ways. It's also referred to as closeout letter for the 03-05 biennium. I'd like to make a couple general points, and then I'm going to encourage Ms. Todd, who is my deputy and responsible for our budget, to walk you through the document and take any questions that you might have. Amongst the preliminary comments I'd like to make is to take you back to April of this year, which was our rebalance. And as you know, at the various points, roughly every 6 months, the department comes forward and informs the legislature as to where we think we are in the current budget biennium, and makes the adjustments and does what is referred to as the rebalance. In that rebalance, we identified a sum of money that we thought was the sum that would be expended in the 03-05 biennium. And I want to point out before we begin this analysis that analysis was correct. The total funds number that we identified was indeed the total funds number that we spent. It was balanced as of April 05. Where things went awry is in what's known as the mix of funding sources. As to the funding sources, we identified a certain general fund requirement and a certain other funds requirement to generate the revenues necessary to achieve that total spending. That funding mix analysis was incorrect, and as it turns out. And it was incorrect for a variety of reasons, a number of which we'll cover in the discussion. I should point out, too, in my second preliminary matter, that at that time, the other funds, the ability of the department to track its other fund revenues was under question by this legislative body. In fact, if you refer to the analysis done by Legislative Fiscal, they quote the House Bill 5077, that the budget note contained in that House bill said to review, it directed DHS to review the procedures it uses to forecast budget and account for other funds and federal fund revenues and present a report on its findings and recommendations to the emergency board at the time of the department's first 2005-2007 biennium budget rebalance. That rebalance will come in January, and we are on track to do that. The motivation for that note was the reality that we altered the mix in April of 2005 and said we're really going to need more general fund than we currently are, than we had previously anticipated. And as you might imagine, the legislature was not pleasantly moved by that news and concerned about what the future would hold, and articulated this budget note as a result. And the worst fears of all of us have been realized. The other fund analysis continued to be faulty for a variety of reasons, and we result in the closeout numbers that are before you today. I think it perhaps would be wisest if we were to look through each piece and take a look at how that balance comes to be. Some of the pieces are less controversial than others. There's some case fund questions. There's the MUPL settlement number that is included in that. But then there are two pieces that I think are, again, in the words of legislative fiscal, disappointing. And I would encourage Todd to walk us through that, if that's all right with you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Mr. Todd.
Okay. For the record, my name is Vic Todd. I'm the Assistant Director for Finance and Policy. And where I'd like to begin is on the second page. I think Brian has talked a lot about what is actually referenced on the first page, and just begin to walk through each of the clusters, individual items for this closeout. Item number one is related to child welfare. In that we had higher caseloads than had been anticipated there, and a larger number of children who were non-4E eligible, meaning that we could not use federal funds for their eligibility. That's about a $7.9 million general fund need. Within contracted adoptions program and the tribal youth investment, we had a savings overall of about $1 million general fund. Within the self-sufficiency child safety programs, and predominantly it's the child care and temporary assistance to needy families programs and domestic violence, we had savings in the DV program and ability to use more federal funds than we had originally anticipated, and that's a $10 million general fund savings. As part of the department's reorganization, the department moved to using a single cost allocation plan rather than having seven or so different cost allocation plans, which is what we had when we were structured as divisions. This is the first biennium where we have had a full biennium of experience with that. And so as a result of that, you'll see this in a couple places that the federal participation is actually lower than what we had anticipated. And that's a $3.4 million general fund need within the CAP programs. Within the Community Human Services, again referencing this is 0305, and this particular cluster no longer exists for the 0507, we had other fund revenues that were less than what had been anticipated in the April-May plan, and that was a $2 million overall general fund need. And finally, within CHS, the administrative expenditures in that cluster were less than what we had projected by a little over $2 million. Moving to seniors, there are really three issues affecting the nursing facility category. Legislation that was passed in the 05 session changed our ability to collect a final adjustment in the 04 period, and as well as made a small adjustment for the continuing care retirement community costs, and that resulted in about $1.6 million general fund need. And overall, nursing facility caseloads were slightly higher than what we had projected. That was roughly about $1 million need, and this these issues are partially offset by higher than anticipated other fund revenues in this category. Within the in-home care costs, the client-employed provider benefit costs overall were less than projected, and this breaks into two pieces, caseload savings of about $10 million general and, the benefits were $10 million and the caseload was $7 million. Other in-home care costs for personal care costs were higher by about $1 million than what we had anticipated, and a greater amount of the Oregon Supplemental Income Program costs, which is a general fund cost of about $500,000. Item number 11, the Older Americans Act, which is 100% federal funds, in closing out the former divisions books and moving from those seven divisions to one agency, you actually closed all the books on those old agencies, and what the financial services people determined was that they had actually been overdrawn in federal funds, and this dated back to about 1992, and it didn't really become visible until they actually just closed the door on that. So that resulted in an additional $2.5 million cost to the department.
Doesn't say much for our auditing capability, huh?
Pardon?
Doesn't say much for our auditing capability if we carried forward a $2.5 million overpayment, or we were in the red in that account for 13 years.
Some of that has to do with the state year versus the federal year and how they treat the cash in terms of, I think it's just something they didn't fully realized was there.
I'm sure.
Who's they?
They is the amorphous group of folks that have no name nor
they
sold to save or bottom to spank. Right?
Excuse me.
Who are they?
Richard and Senator Winters. They are DHS. So the financial staff is who I'm referring to. Item number 12, again, is related to the single cost allocation plan in terms of what we had estimated for federal revenues and versus what actually occurred, and that resulted in an additional $3.7 million need. Within community facilities, the cost per case there was somewhat lower than anticipated. And removing some MP federal limitation. The Oregon Project Independence spending also came in slightly lower than what was in the budget, a little over $400,000. And finally, there was less contract settlement money coming in from the DD contracts than what we had projected. The item 14 is reflecting the monies that the legislature gave us as part of the April plan to help meet the temporary cash flow problems that we were experiencing related to provider taxes. And so this is just reflecting that as that general fund piece as a savings. The last item on this page is related to the Medicare upper payment limit. The department has reached final resolution on that, and this reflects the final payout to the federal government in resolving that. The department itself didn't realize any additional revenues from this, but the state realized an additional $300 million or so of revenues for use. Within health services,
Senator Winters.
As I understand, that was an anticipated action, and I don't want anybody to think that this is something that's new and that suddenly cropped up, but it was anticipated that this would occur.
Representative Richardson and Senator Winters, that's correct.
And was the final amount within the range of the estimate that was assumed that we would have to pay the...
Representative Richardson, Senator Winters, I believe that everyone felt that this was a good settlement. We'd been in negotiations for roughly 2 years with the federal government, and it was a good negotiation process, and so I think we all felt that this was a good resolution.
I guess what I'm looking for, when we know that we're going to have to return dollars to the feds and we're anticipating that action to take place, how much was set aside in preparation for that action? I guess that's my question, and whether or not, you know, you were close to that mark, whether you did set that aside, whether that was set aside. Because we've known that this particular action is going to come about for some time. It's not nothing that's new.
Chair Richardson, Senator Winters, when I took over the department in May, this number was on the table as a number we hoped we would be able to settle at. And for your information, I was initially opposed to the settlement and wanted to see if we could hold out to do better, and was advised by everyone that I was mistaken in that assumption, and even conferred with our Washington counsel, who urged that we take the deal that was offered, and so we did.
Do you know how we fared with respect to other states, because we were not the only state?
Yes. Chair Richardson, Senator Winters, every state in their use of MUPRO was different, so it's difficult to compare an apple to an apple. There are some states who have not had to pay anything, although they did use MUPRO dollars. You'd have to compare how they use them and to what extent, but the consensus of opinion seems to be that we did, I want to be fair about this, that both the federal government and our state government were well served with the resolution.
Okay. Moving to health services, first item there, number 16, it talks about the medical caseloads, and they're proved to be higher than what we had estimated. Again, the continued growth in the TANF and Aid to the Blind and Disabled programs, and some additional unexpected growth in the Children's Health Insurance Program. And that resulted in a $6.2 million general fund need. Item number 17 is talking about an adjustment to the tobacco tax revenue that was available to the department. The May estimate that followed the rebalance plan was actually somewhat lower, and so this reflects that the department received less tobacco tax revenue than what we had anticipated at that point, of about $2 million. Again, item number 18 is another item that is a carryover from the closing out.
I'm just going to wait until the very end, but there's a couple things that come up that, rather than just going back, I'll just ask while we're at it. Can you tell us why the $1.96 million or the $2 million shortfall on tobacco revenues was the determination that DHS came up with, and then when we're finally doing the closeout, we have Department of Revenue saying that there's $5.1 million of additional tobacco tax money that gets added back in?
Representative Richardson, in the initial, when we submitted the initial letter, this item was at about $7 million. And that was based upon the information that we had from Department of Revenue in terms of what tobacco tax revenue we would expect. Subsequent to the submission of that letter, in working both with budget management and with Department of Revenue, it was determined that there was still an additional $5.1 million of tobacco tax revenue that the department would be receiving. And so that's the difference between what was in the letter and what is showing here. The estimates that we use, we use what the Department of Revenue provides for us in terms of the tobacco tax revenue that we would receive.
Okay.
Does that help? Item number 18 again is indirect funds within public health that had not been utilized. That was a carryover item from closing the books on the public health division, and so it was additional revenue that we determined to be available, and so it results in a slight general fund savings, and it's partially offset by a Death with Dignity Challenge lawsuit costs. Now, the final item on page 6 is the reference to the cash flow issue, just showing that general fund that was in, within health services in terms of their portion. Within the department-wide support services category, the first item there is reflection of interest costs that we incur related to both the cash flow issue and just in how the financial services area has to operate in order to make payments. And for this biennium, it's about $1 million additional need. Item 21 is a mix really of two issues. The first being the cost allocation issue that I mentioned earlier, and the second issue there is really related to some of the errors that occurred in estimating revenues for the April plan. And really in that particular category, one of the issues that we're working through is to get the identification of revenues down to a more detailed level. And at the point at which we were doing the April estimates, analysts were using really what were, in essence, a summary level. And so in some cases they missed the fact that the amount of revenue that had been received up to a point in time was in fact the entire amount. The example here for DWSS is that a category that was referred to as an other fund category called Medicaid MAP actually contained about 7 items, one of which was certificate of participation funding for the MMIS project. And while that project had been, the expected expenditures had been reduced because of the delay in the project, the analysts didn't realize that it was also where, in this Medicaid map, was where the certificate of participation revenue was. And so they projected forward from the point in time that they were doing their revenue projections, assuming that revenue that had been accrued to that point would continue to grow, when in fact it wouldn't. And so that's part of the revenue issue within DWSS. A further issue in there within this Medicaid map, another category there was the SPD Estates sale revenue. And not knowing that was in there, and the analysts having identified that actually that was a revenue source that should come into DWSS, they established a separate line for that. And so they double counted about $1.7 million of revenue in that category. So that brings us to the bottom line reversion amount of $22.8 million general fund.
In your discussion relating to DWSS department wide support services, as I look through the materials, I see that in House Bill 5077, their DWSS used $9.6 million of general fund to backfill other and federal fund shortfalls in its internal and federal cost allocation estimates. And now you're coming back and saying there's $17.8 million more. So we're talking about $27.4 million of miscalculations just in this one area. And so while we're talking about 17.8 at this point, it's actually 27 if you take in $27 million, if we take in what happened a few months ago. Can you explain why this takes place? I mean, I know, well, no, we just need to have you explain.
Sure.
What's going on when you have a $27 million whoops?
Representative Richardson, the portion when I was talking about the revenue misestimation, that's about $6.2 million of that of this 17. So I'm not minimizing that, but and so the balance of that is related to the cost allocation. In this biennium, what we used really for the basis for estimating federal participation was really based upon what we had experienced historically under the seven different cost allocation plans. And we were attempting to estimate what it would be under the new cost allocation plan. So this particular part of the department is very dependent on cost allocation because it is all of those service areas and costs that in order to make a federal claim, there has to be a basis for that, and the basis comes really from the program clusters and how they're delivering services. And so as the service mix changes you implement this cost allocation plan, you end up with a different outcome. And so it's basically simply that our estimates were incorrect. And we now have a biennium of history from which we can, improve that, what we should expect. And we're working on a lot of different things in terms of both the revenue tracking and the expenditure tracking, so that we're looking at things in sync. So we're looking at how the revenue is coming in and how it's being applied, and wanting to do that on a monthly basis so that we can see that the revenue has been received to the right place and ultimately has been applied to the right place.
We have a couple of areas that come to the surface. One is your forecasting.
Yes.
Because if everything you've said, we see slightly higher caseload benefits overall, less than expected, exceeded. Now, it's in all fairness, you can't get exact numbers. And so we don't have a clear understanding as to whether the divergence is excessive or not. It would be very helpful in the interim for us to find out how we compare with other states and whether or not these things are correct it's acceptable or not acceptable. The accounting problems are even a much greater issue, especially to the public. If we go back to February of 2004, DHS discovered $117.2 million that had been set aside for standard population that weren't there, which was used to backfill a substantial amount of the lost revenue from the failure of the tax increase to go through under Measure 30 in the referendum. Now we are $55 million short from what was expected. During the session, essentially, the state, we used $77.7 million of advanced money because of an accounting problem. My recollection was that it was basically a cash basis versus accrual basis accounting problem, where the DHS had determined the budget for their revenue for the 2003-2005 biennium to include $77 million of money that wouldn't come in until after the biennium is ended. And is that basically correct? We're talking about tax revenue and provider tax.
Representative Richardson, I'll try to respond to, I think you've asked maybe three or four questions.
Right now I'm just focusing on, am I correct that the $77.7 million that we advanced in the last session was to help finish the prior biennium because there had been budgeting taking place, assuming that money would have come in during the biennium. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, I think you are correct, and if I'm wrong, Mr. Todd will tell me, but I want to point something out. That's the second time you've given us a cash advance like that. First time was at the end of the 01 session. As you turn your reliance to other funds from general fund, then the timing of the receipt of those other funds becomes crucial. And our expenditures that are anticipated happen in the biennium, and the funds that are associated with providing those services are receipted after the biennium. And so both in the 01 and then again, in the 03, at the end of 03, and at the end of 05, we turned to you and said, can we have a cash advance? And you provided that.
So what you're saying is that we as a body continue to pass a budget, assuming that that money's going to be there when it's really not, and so at the end of the 05-07 biennium, it's going to happen again. Is that correct? That there's going to be another rebalance where we're going to have to come up with money again because the current budget is based on funds that won't not all of which will come in during this biennium.
Representative Richardson, that is correct. I think that the way that this department has been budgeted, and it's a fundamental issue when you're talking about 150 or 200 different other fund sources, that you are trying to estimate every one of those. With the example you're talking about in terms of the when we came to you and asked for cash flow monies, what that was really in reference to is the provider tax and tobacco tax revenues do not flow into the department until, in this instance, after June 30 for the most part. Mm-hmm. And so in order for us to continue to operate, we had to have additional general fund revenue to be able to function.
Okay, so that's our responsibility to either, in our budgeting process, go to a full cash basis or accept the fact that we're going to have to do this. So we can take responsibility for that. But at the time that we advanced the $77.7 million, we understood that there would be a final MUPL agreement and that there was going to be a $1.6 million that would be lost in provider tax under House Bill 2147. So we understood that roughly. There was $55 million that we expected would come in after adjustments that were anticipated, and now that money didn't make it back, and you've gone through and pointed out where the discrepancies were. Sometimes there was a positive and sometimes there was a negative, but the end result is that we're between $30 and $40 million in the hole from where we expect it to be today. Is that basically where we're at?
Mr. Chair? Yes.
Okay. What are we going to do to assure that we aren't in this position again? I mean, we'd like to have your response on how can we improve the forecasting. We had a problem with penal forecasting a few years ago. It got shifted to another group, and it's much more accurate because they're forecasters. And, is that something that ought to be looked at? And then the issue of accounting, so that we can feel more secure that we don't have to keep coming and doing this for things that are within your control, not things within our control.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, let's break those two pieces and deal with them separately. On the forecasting piece, there are a range of options that you can pursue. There was some discussion about that during the close of last legislative session, and I think you'd find the department open to having those discussions. I also think you would find the department of the opinion, at least until it's shown otherwise, that the industry standards that would be applied to forecasting would find our forecasters are not as inept as some of these numbers might suggest. One of the reasons I say that is because a small deviation in forecast can result in a huge cost given the size of the budget of the Department of Human Services.
So, is that fair to use a huge budget for Department of Human Services because it's all made up of components?
And
a large corporation,
right,
with 50 plants, and you have one plant that is way off, you don't say, well, it's a minor effect on the entire balance sheet of the corporation. You would look at that one plant and say, what can we do to make sure the efficiency is appropriate in this one area or this one cluster?
You're absolutely right, Mr. Chair, and I'm suggesting that we do that comparison on a program-by-program basis. And if we discover that there's an inability to forecast with accuracy, then I think one of your earlier suggestions would be appropriate. Let's see if our sister states can forecast that with accuracy. But I think you'd find that our forecasting unit is improving constantly and is not does not deviate far from the industry standard mean. It's unfortunate that any deviations in that will result when you've got millions and millions of dollars at stake and millions of dollars off. 2% off on a $100 million budget is $2 million. So I think you're right. That's one of them. Then the second question is, what can we do about the failure to anticipate these other revenues in an accurate manner. And that is a mistake inside our system that has to be fixed. It's an inexcusable situation. And the legislature knew this when I say knew this, knew that this was an area of the Department of Human Services that needed work. When we passed the April rebalance, we were directed to make sure we had it for January, and we're working to have that for you in January. The reality of the situation is that if we're going to be so desperately dependent on other funds, then we better be pretty good at anticipating them. Otherwise, this kind of conduct will continue to occur, and it's unacceptable.
Because our committee has to deal with the question, is it an issue of malfeasance, or is it an issue of an acceptable mistake? And the difficulty is that over time, these kinds of meetings happen over and over and over again, and with the turnover at the top of DHS, it's easy to not have accountability because it was on somebody else's watch, and we're fully aware that you've only been in your position for 4 months and that you're on your way transitioning to a better life. You're retiring. I have a question.
Representative Richardson, can I comment? Because I think it's when we talk about forecasting, what Brian's been talking about around forecasting is it was actually related to the caseload forecasting. So the discussion of the estimations of other fund revenues is a different type of forecasting. I think it would be a different type of discussion. And we take this, very seriously, because it's easy to back away from it and say, we're only 1.8% off from the general fund meet, and say that's very good, but we realize because of the size of this department that that's a significant amount of money, and so we are working through, the MUPL residue in terms of, ensuring that we have cleaned out that limitation in terms of how it was and where it was placed in the department. And that is a significant piece of this issue. And we're, pretty confident that we have got it out of there now. And so that's a big step. But we are working very hard on, setting up revenue tracking processes, setting up our allotment process to align to that in our expenditures.
One thing, certainly in your favor, is that we want transparency, and you're coming forward and saying, here's what's happened, and we would like to, we understand that this same thing is not going to happen, but we want to make sure that there are changes in the accounting procedures in the department to assure that it doesn't just show up in other ways, in other areas.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I think there's also an unnecessary and undue complication to this whole thing. I would say the department has suffered from a little bit of a perfect storm analogy. They have, as you suggested earlier, revolving door policy at the very top of the organization. That's not helpful for stability. They've been pushed into a reorganization or went voluntarily into a reorganization that was in essence quite good for the organization, I would argue, but quite disruptive. They're now in the situation where this is their very first biennium. They've just concluded their first biennium with a single budget, which is a huge undertaking for an organization approaching $10 billion. Mm-hmm. So that's the first time they have that. And then they got hit by the PERS wave of retirements. So all throughout the financial services that I mentioned, we have people who are excellent people. I would stack them, as you may know, Mr. Chair, I was the dean of a management school for 4 years. I would stack them up against graduates and professors at that institution and say they're high quality people. But they're also new to their assignments. And so what you have is all this coming together and then us coming here and saying, by the way, could you write us a check for $55
million? Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Senator Winner.
Senator Gordy just slipped me a note and said I predicted this last session. And some of the comments that are being made are very accurate because the agency has gone through a huge reorganization and it's totally transformed itself. My question is that we know what was, and we knew that MUPL was coming down. We knew that we were going to have that to deal with, and this body was a partner in what was happening with MUPL, so we cannot say that we operated in a vacuum and did not know that the Medicaid up limit would come at one point that we would have to pay for that piece of that $300 million that we were able to leverage and get. So that's a piece that I think that we understand. My question is going forward, because we can talk about what was, but I'd like to talk about what we're going to do. You know, what are we going to do to avoid, 6 months from now, a year from now, of continuing to have a shortfall, to continuing to come back to where we have the oops that we suddenly found, as the chair said, $100+ million, and then the oops that now says we don't have enough revenue. What are we going to do to make certain that setting up the 7 accounts under programs, that accountability is inside of that account, and that you're able to track both the general fund dollars as well as the federal dollars and the other funds? I think that really is the fundamental question, so that when coming to this body, that we not only your legislators have a comfort zone, but that we're able to say to the public that this really is what is necessary, needed, and this is what we spent.
Let me try first. Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, I'd like to articulate 3 points. One, several months ago, I went and recruited John Yunker to come to the department as a contract employee to do a little work on our. I asked him if he would accept a title of enzyme, and would be the catalyst for a review of this sort of work. And he has been kind enough to come out of retirement and assist with that. Now, I'm not suggesting that he's giving us the answers. I was specific about that. I didn't want the answers from him. What I wanted was his assistance in developing the process and developing these young people so that they can handle their responsibilities. Second, I would say that during the transition with Dr. Goldberg, we have been focused on this, and I think that he has some organizational plans that will continue the progress that has been made and deepen it and enrichen it. And third, I would say that Vic Todd has done a tremendous amount of work in grasping this problem and searching out. MUPL has been a cancer, and it appears hidden throughout the body of DHS. And he's done a good job of surgically finding it and removing it. And I think all those things combined suggest that the future is brighter. Although I would say that this, as I said in each of my comments in quote in the newspaper, this is a structural problem. It occurred when we created our first budget, 2003-2005, and the seeds of it are planted in 2005-2007 as well. And so we'll have to deal with that at some point. I will be watching your hearings in January with great interest.
Well, I'd like to follow, because I'd like some response to that question of what kind of timetable, because you have the largest state agency in state government, 9,000+ employees. And, it doesn't escape any of us that there's issues of morale. And, by the way, you've got some excellent employees inside of the department, and I think that needs to be said, too. But I think you need to give us, as we look at the structure, there is problems with the structure. What is it going to take to build a better structure, and how much time, so that we're not coming back here constantly addressing these same issues?
Representative Richardson, Senator Winters, I've talked about a couple of things that we're doing, and I view those as really short-term measures. I think in the long term that we do have systemic issues that we need to work on, and that we need to improve, from the point that revenue comes in the door, how we look at that, how we determine, where does this revenue belong, and how is it to be expended. Currently, a lot of what we do is very manual, and that creates the opportunity for a lot of error. And so, my concern is that there always will be volatility in what we do. And so, to the degree that we can remove those error opportunities, you know, the lower will be the probability that we come back and say, well, this was an error, as opposed to this was an outcome that was different than we anticipated, but it's not founded on an error. So that is what we're working on. What the processes I was talking about earlier are really still a manual process, and we're looking at what other types of systems are out there for organizations of our size to enable us to do things more from a technology standpoint, quite simply, because we can't immediately go and find out what a revenue is and where it's located, how it's been used. And large organizations need to be able to do that to effectively track things.
I have a concern that's kind of a systemic concern. Maybe you can clarify it for me. During the course of our budget negotiations and hearings, the committee was dealing with whether or not to accept the governor's revised budget recommendation for a lifting of GRB, DRG rates, hospital rates, to 90%, and we as a body chose to hold them at 72% where they were at the time that we were doing all the negotiations. But I just found out yesterday that shortly after the session ended that DHS for fee-for-service raised them to 100%, and that was done without any notice to me as the chair of the subcommittee, and I asked our co-chair, and he knew nothing about it, who was, you know, the House co-chair over budget. And so I'm wondering, you know, that's just one little thing, but does DHS wait until after the session's over and then go forward and do exactly what they want, even if it's contrary to legislative intent? Or was that a mere mistake? Or maybe I just didn't understand how that change took place. Can you explain that?
Mr. Chair, that change took place pending some negotiations with the hospitals and with an understanding of what we were trying to accomplish in terms of the generation of revenue and the compensation to the hospitals. 100% is, of course, matchable. And so there's as you generate that increase, you generate an increased amount of federal other funds coming into the department as well. And that decision was reached. I put that into place on August 15th. That's when that went into place. It was reached as a temporary rule, and as a matter of fact, I'm having a meeting with the hospitals tomorrow where I'm going to discuss the corresponding increase in taxes. So the tax rate to the hospitals is going up as well.
Was there a public hearing on that decision to move that up? My understanding is, I've asked around, is that there are consequences to other organizations that are negative and that they were not consulted, and there's no...
The other organizations were invited to meetings post that temporary decision and have been active participants since then. And so those negative consequences, I am aware of those and tried to take those into consideration when I reached the decision as to what the permanent outcome would be, in which I intend to announce tomorrow in the meeting with the hospitals.
Was it your intention to do that before our session ended?
It was not.
It was not brought up with us when it could have been?
I think it could have been had I known that I was going to go in that direction. I did not know that at the time.
Okay. Just concerned about
it. That makes perfect sense.
And appear to be maverick, you know, when the legislature really needs to be consulted when an agency is about to do something contrary to what was clearly a legislative intent at the time that the session was in session. Other thoughts, comments? If we could hear from our analysts then. Thank you. Pam.
Mr. Chair and members of the subcommittee, I'm Pam Tesher again from the Department of Administrative Services. And we recommend that you approve the request with some modifications. As Mr. Todd pointed out, they did receive $5 million of tobacco tax that they had not accounted for in their letter. So our recommendation is that you transfer general fund appropriations, that you increase other funds, expenditure limitations, as LFO recommends as well, by approximately $32.6 million,
and the excess federal funds that will be unscheduled.
Okay. Mr. Britton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Our recommendation is on the fourth page of our analysis. We would recommend that you make general fund transfers, two of them, both from health services, increase the general fund of the department-wide support services cluster budget by $18,847,743. And again, another transfer to the seniors and people with disabilities cluster of $15,423,011 of general fund. That you increase the other funds expenditure limitation within the SPD budget cluster for $32,578,858. This will allow the MUPL resolution to actually be legal in this instance. And finally, to increase the health services federal funds expenditure limitation by $10,889,770.
Discussion or questions of the analysts? If not, the chair would accept a motion. Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move that the recommendation, as discussed by LFO, be move forward to the board with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Representative Hannah moves that the LFO recommendations on item 11 go to the e-board with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion on the motion? Is there objection? Hearing none, motion carries, and I will carry this. Thank you very much. Will you be coming back up?
I'm up for the next two, I believe, Mr. Chair.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you for the clarifications, Mr. Todd. We now go to item 12, report on capital construction project at Oregon State Hospital's Cortland facility.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is the construction the remodeling of a space so that we can take some people out of Building J. I'm going to turn it over with your permission to Bob Nickel and ask him to speak on the matter.
Welcome. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Nickel, and I'm Assistant Director for the Department of Human Services, Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services. The request that we are making is, the purpose of it is to allow us to proceed as quickly as possible to renovate the sixth floor of the Oregon State Hospital Portland campus in order to move somewhere between 28 and 32 patients from the Salem campus up there in order to begin to relieve the situation on the 41 building at Oregon State Hospital in the J building complex, which, as you all are aware, from the master plan phase one report, presents some significant seismic risk to approximately 100 patients and the staff associated with that unit. So we've explored a number of other options. We'll continue to explore those options and report as you would like to the legislature, the emergency board, or whenever you would like that to happen. But the immediate need is to move forward first with getting an engineering study, which we're in the process of getting, which will allow us to get a much firmer estimate of the cost of renovating that sixth floor. The sixth floor up there in that building is not at all set up at this point in terms of privacy or other functions for a psychiatric hospital. As I understand the situation, it's kind of an open structure, and it had curtains and other things that were appropriate for some kinds of medical purposes when the Holiday Park Hospital closed 12 years ago. But it would require significant renovation in order to use it. So our request was originally to establish a construction project. We've since had a useful discussion with Legislative Fiscal Office, and in reviewing the statutory requirements around certificates of participation, it appears that we could not use COPs in order to do this, and it's likely to require a general fund allocation at some point. So at this point, I think this is more in the form of a report to the emergency board so that you're aware of what we're doing. And I think that covers the main points that are in our letter.
Okay. Questions, Mr. Nickel? I have one, and maybe it's not one that you can answer, but you mentioned that this has been, it's been in a current configuration on the sixth floor for 12 years. Has the state been renting that floor for 12 years?
Mr. Chair, no, we have rented only as high as the fifth floor. I think we have the first, maybe part of the second floor and the fifth floor. But the sixth floor has been unoccupied during this period of time.
But, Mr. Chair, it is part of the original lease. We didn't use the space, however.
Okay, that's really what I was getting to, is we have had that space leased, and we have been paying for it. State taxpayers have been paying for it. But in my understanding, it hasn't been used?
Mr. Chair, that would be correct.
And the only thing it's used for is the occasional meeting.
Talking about 18,000 square feet?
Is that right?
So, as a director, would you like to comment on the efficacy of the utilization of tax dollars to rent 18,000 square feet for an occasional meeting over a period of years?
Mr. Chair, the 18,000 square feet that's on the sixth floor isn't readily marketable to any other source because of our use of the rest of the building. So is it part of the lease? Yes, it is. It's covered by the lease, but it's not space that in the negotiation we're paying top dollar for or that we're they have no other mechanism by which they can generally put that out.
Okay, well, I know you weren't there, but I'm putting just kind of on the record that this is an example of a waste of tax dollars, because if you were a business owner and you're about to lease a portion of a building and you can only use five floors, you would rent five floors, or maybe you'd go five floors with an option on the sixth floor, which a landlord would go along with, because you're going to do five floors and they'll give you an option and then they can rent the other floor. But it sounds to me like DHS has rented a sixth floor, we've been paying rent on it for years, we've had no benefit for it from it, and that it's been a waste of taxpayer money. Would you agree with that assessment?
I wouldn't know enough to agree or disagree with Chair Richardson. I'd want to see the lease and see how we've used it exactly. The question that you ask is a good one. It hasn't come up in the discussions I've had on this property.
Okay, second question is, we're about to put somewhere between $750 and close to $1 million in renovation for leased space, when we could do a renovation of current space for $1.5 million. In your discussions, has there been discussion about putting that kind of money into a leased facility as compared to into a facility that is currently owned by the state?
One of the things, Chair Richardson, that we would do next, if you authorize this, is to make some determinations about what it would cost us, how the pieces would come together, and then enter into the negotiation. And it has to be with the property owner. It has to be cost-effective for us to make that decision to go there or to come back to you and say, you know, given what they're putting on the table, it is better for us to spend the 1.5 and renovate somewhere else.
Okay, now, in all fairness, would you tell me how long the ongoing lease is? How long do we have this space leased for in the future?
The lease will expire in April of 2015.
Okay, so it's a 10-year lease. We have an option for additional time.
Why don't you come up and join us?
Of course, what I'm getting at is, you know, if this is a 2-year lease and you're going to put $1 million into it, that would be crazy. If it's a long lease and it's in a metropolitan area, sometimes that's just what you do. You amortize it over the length of the lease.
Mr. Chair, I'm Maynard Hammer, Deputy Superintendent of Oregon State Hospital. The lease is actually, the original lease was entered into in 1995. The original lease had an option to continue, which when we renewed in April, the original lease had a lease rate in it that Legacy willingly acceded to. So we have a 10-year lease. We're paying $1.50 a square foot on that 18,000 square feet, which the average DAS office space rent in Portland is $1.54. So one of the issues that entered into the policy discussions about the sixth floor is if we didn't have that and had to move the hospital or needed expansion space, that's about all we could get in that general area. It is our best treatment space. One of the benefits of Portland is that there are a lot of community facilities, amenities there. for our patients in the in engaging in recovery activities. There's a lot more available there than surrounding Oregon State Hospital here in Salem. The sixth floor, and while I wasn't at the hospital when it was leased, we lease the first floor, the second floor, the fifth floor, and the sixth floor. The first, second, and fifth floor, a strange configuration, but the other floors remain with Legacy. The sixth floor was medical space, medical ward, was never converted. The other three floors were psychiatric treatment space. And I think that entered into the decision to occupy the first three floors and not the sixth floor. So what we're really talking about here is going in and converting that 18,000 square feet to modern psychiatric treatment space. It's medical space. The floors need rework. The restrooms are not in good shape. It hasn't been occupied or used at all except for meetings and ancillary space. Our current lease is at $1.50 a square foot through 2008. Then we go to $1.83 for the next 5 years. I'm sorry, that's not right. Through 2011, and into $2.08 per square foot for the remaining time on the lease. It's net of utilities. We pay $2.50 per foot for the whole year for utilities for 5 years, and that goes up to $2.75. On balance, given the prospects of trying to move or change, I certainly can't disagree with you that leasing space that we aren't using for treatment space is not the most economic use. But on balance, if we didn't have that space and we were now trying to find additional space for these patients, we don't believe it's available. Citing a hospital, any kind of a hospital, in particular a psychiatric secure facility, is not easy and would take a very long time. The primary reason two primary reasons that we suggest going there rather than retrofitting a building on the campus were the driver here was to move as quickly as we could to remove people from our most seismically challenged buildings. The Portland space, since we already leased it, was the quickest and easiest, even though it's not cheap and still will take the better part of a year to reach fruition, assuming that we get proposals and can move forward on it. The request for proposals for an architect or engineer are due today. Mm-hmm. I don't know how many proposals we'll get. I'd be happy to answer any other questions.
Senator Gorley.
Thank you.
Senator Winters.
Thank you very much. I'd like to speak to that point. Could you talk about the factors that you're weighing in your discussions, your negotiations with Legacy Health System, the factors that will decide which way you go? Will they do the construction versus will DHS do the construction? And given that there is no budget, as we sit here for this line item in the DHS budget. So what are the factors that you're weighing?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, we approached when we asked Legacy if they had any problem with us expanding our patient treatment space there in June. We asked them if they had any problem with that, and they said no, you lease the space, you should use it. We also asked them if they would be willing to finance it and build it into the lease rate. They said no. After the LFO suggested revisiting that, we worked through DAS because DAS manages all of our leases, and actually we've had very good response, and Legacy has a good relationship with DAS's leasing agent there. We asked them formally, will you finance this? And we have a formal response back that they're not in a position to do that. We have not asked them at this point whether there was any negotiable room in the lease rate to recover the state's capital cost. Having done some of this stuff in past lives, I haven't asked this question. I would believe that there a hospital. That's in the Holiday Park Medical Center. That's what that area there is called. The rest of the space there is research. Legacy is not operating an acute care hospital there. And I think those are some of the factors that would enter into whether they're willing to reduce what we think is probably a favorable lease rate to recover state capital costs for psychiatric space that they may not use. There may be some room there if we have to improve plumbing and other things that are part building systems. But we haven't really had a chance to explore those with Legacy yet.
And one follow-up. What is the timeline, again, for moving the 30 patients? You want to accomplish that by what date?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, I believe that assuming the construction is between $750,000 and $1 million, that's probably a 9 to 11-month construction period to occupation. So we're talking at least through toward the end of next summer if all goes well. If we're right in what we think the construction project will be. We're really hoping for an architect or an engineer to go in and look at what it takes to bring the treatment space up to psychiatric treatment standards, do some schematics, specify what would be required, and do some formal cost estimates so that we know the magnitude of the construction and also have reliable cost estimates to bring back to you folks.
And one additional question. Is there a plan B should this effort not go the way that you wish it to? Plan B.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, we've continually been looking at other options as we've gone along, because even if we do this, there are still 70 patients that mm-hmm. we're going to be very concerned about. Mm-hmm. So, yes, we are exploring some other options right now. We've occasionally had people call us, and we've gone out and looked at some other possibilities. I have to say that there's not a lot out there that can be done without significant additional costs, but we are exploring those.
Is there a reason why, if you didn't happen to have this space, but you're looking for space, because you are anyway, for the additional patients, why you would want to locate this kind of a facility in a downtown urban area where the costs are the greatest in the state?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think the other places... part of it just really depends on where there is anything that resembles a psychiatric hospital that could be renovated. Most of those, frankly, are in the Portland metropolitan area, so that's simply one factor. Are we looking at other possibilities? We will if we can find anything that's in a less expensive area.
Okay, so the answer, though, is there's no real reason to locate it in this area for its closeness to medical facilities or anything else. It's just that you have the space.
Well, it's not, if I may inject, just to clarify, the location that we're speaking of is not downtown Portland.
Oh, I'm sorry. I haven't looked where the address is. Mm-hmm. I'm from the southern part of the state.
And in terms of its closeness to other resources, community-based, well, you know, some could argue that it's ideal given its location.
Okay. Mr. Chair,
Senator Wynn.
Question: how does this fit in with the overall master planning that's going on with the state hospital and community facilities? Because, you know, I think as you're talking this, my question is: how does it interface and fit with what we're talking about for the future?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, this is really a temporary kind of fix that we're looking at. We know that whatever we do in terms of the construction of a new hospital and, you know, related community facilities, because I really think we need to think about both of those, not just a new state hospital building. But even if we started breaking ground today, Maynard Hammer and others informed me that it would probably be 4 or 5 years before we'd start moving patients, at least into a new centralized state hospital. So this is it's frankly a stopgap measure. And one of the things that it does is, behooves us not to make a lot of stranded, very expensive investments on the old state hospital campus right now, because we really not only know that it's very expensive to renovate buildings that are in not very good shape already, but if we're going to be moving off the campus or doing other things with the campus, we need to be prudent, I think, in what we make in the way of investments there.
follow-up, and I would agree. But also I know that part of the plan is to, you're not going to have the same kind of campus that we had, that we see today, and that part of that population will not continue to be in Salem. So you are looking outside of the Salem area. And as you make your planning forward, I wondered how much of this could you connect to the master plan?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, I think your point is well taken, and that whatever we do now, we should think about the relationship to where we go in the next 3 or 4 years.
Okay, well, just kind of in conclusion, we've got two issues. One is the request, which is to utilize a fourth of the space that's been rented for over 10 years through, you know, retrofit or remodeling so that it will apply to some future use, which we need. And the other is one that is lingering, and that is assuming that the cost was roughly $1.50 a foot for 18,000 feet, one-fourth of your rented space has set empty at $27,000 a month with no attempt that I'm aware of to sublet it or to utilize, have it be utilized by other government agencies or other government departments, and that has... that disturbs me that a fourth of the rented space would sit empty, roughly, generally empty for over 10 years, when we're paying for that out of funds that are, you know, could have been utilized elsewhere, or that are being utilized elsewhere that could have been saved by having someone else, some other department or some other organization, utilize that 18,000 square feet. Any final comment on that?
Mr. Chair, I think we hear the points you're making.
Okay. Any other questions for these reps? Then we could hear from our analysts. Thank you, Deputy Tanner.
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, I'm Pam Teschner with the Department of Administrative Services, and we request that you acknowledge receipt of the report.
Okay, thank you. Mr.
Chair and members, we also recommend that you acknowledge receipt of the report. We would further recommend that you direct DHS to return to the January meeting of the board with a more detailed report that at the least includes the following, and I've listed those on the second page of the analysis. First, a list of alternatives to the legacy capital construction project, along with costs and timelines. It sounded as though that this is probably the best alternative at this point, but a list of alternatives would be helpful because it may also lead to the second bullet point, which is a discussion of how and where the other 70 forensic patients currently residing in the J building might be placed. So if there are other alternatives, perhaps some of those might lead to placement of the other 70 persons. A firm cost estimate for the legacy project and a discussion of how that would be financed. A discussion of the project negotiations with Legacy Health System and a possible request for funding after considering where we are with the proposed January 2006 departmental rebalance plan.
Questions of the analysts?
Mr. Chair,
Senator Gordon,
to the second bullet point, we're asking the agency to come back with a discussion of how and where the other 70 forensic patients currently residing in the J building might be placed. I think we need to add and when. That's
important.
These are all activities that are taking place, hopefully with an increasing sense of urgency. Again, we have patients living in conditions that are unsafe, and that causes me to ask the question, how vulnerable does that leave us to lawsuits, given that, again, the structure that these patients, and I stress patients, are currently in is it's an unsafe facility.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair.
Senator Winter.
And I go back to the plans that are being put forth with the master plan, because part of getting us to the master plan was the whole issue of the state hospital and it being unsafe and the conditions. So, I'd still like to know how this ties in to what they're planning for the future.
That really is reasonable.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Because it's a lot of money that we're going to be putting in for a stopgap measure, and possibly the master plan would provide for a phased arrangement where that money could be utilized as part of the plan and not merely as a temporary fix.
I would also like to clarify my use of the word ideal earlier when I was referencing the Portland Legacy Hospital as an ideal location. It's ideal given the circumstances that we're in. There's a whole lot more that needs to be said and done around creating community-based options mm-hmm. for these patients, where we know they will have better outcomes. And so I wanted to just make that clarifying point.
Thank you for doing that. I certainly support that as well. I think we all do.
Mr. Chair, I will add in our pony that we write for you tomorrow, or for the carrier, what Senator Gordley added, the timing of all of this, and also what Senator Winters added, how this project fits with the overall master plan direction.
Okay, with that, we would
like a motion. Mr. Chair, I move that we acknowledge the receipt of the report with the instructions that was added by LFO and members of the subcommittee.
Senator Winters moves that we acknowledge the receipt of the report and that there be a return instructions to return the January 06 e-board with the items that we've discussed and are contained in LFO's recommendation with the two additions. Is there a discussion?
I do have a question. I see Mr. Bob Junedeff in our audience from the Oregon Advocacy Center, and do you have additional comments or guidance for this committee on this particular issue?
Are you asking that I invite him to come up and speak?
I am, Mr. Chair, yes.
As a courtesy to Senator Gordley, would you please come forward? I really wasn't planning on bringing up additional ones, but we'll make an exception here.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Gordley. My name is Bob Junedeff. I'm the director of Oregon Advocacy Center. I think your concerns are very well taken, frankly, we've been, I guess the thing that I would report to you is that we have additional concerns about the safety of the patients at the hospital that I'm hoping that you might take into consideration at your January meeting, and that has to do with the staffing levels for the patients who are presently living there. Our understanding is that the present staffing levels for those patients are not sufficient to assure their safety. And so when you're looking at the safety of the residents, you have a problem not only in terms of the building safety, but also in terms of the amount of staffing that's available in order to assure that both the patients and the staff that work there are safe. We brought these concerns to the attention of DHS. We're talking about them, but it may be an additional factor that you want to look at when they come back to talk to you in January.
Mr. Chair, can I amend the motion to include that information as well as, and I requested it before, the workers' comp injury rates at the state hospital. It gives us some sense of really what is going on inside the hospital and how many of our staff are being injured and how many are going into work stop. That would be helpful information for this body.
Okay, Senator Winters has moved that we amend the motion before the committee to include instructions that when the report comes forth at the e-board in January of 06, that it include information relating to staffing and workers' comp issues at the state hospital. Your discussion on the motion to amend?
Discussion, please. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we just heard not only about staffing safety, but patient safety. I think as long as you're going to amend the motion, On one hand, you could say we've got a safety issue. If there are issues and we could learn the specifics of patient safety or see what those issues have been, I think that'd be critical as well.
All right, so the amendment would deal with safety issues, including staffing to patient ratios and other issues relating to patient safety. Is that correct?
That's correct.
All right. Is there further discussion on the amendment? Is there objection to the amendment? None? Then it's so amended, so we're now prepared to vote on the motion as amended. Is there objection? Hearing none? Motion carries. Senator, who would like to carry? Either one? Okay, Senator Gordley, would you carry this tomorrow?
Yes, I will.
And all right, thank you very much. And we'll now go to our next item, which is number 13, grant application regarding epidemiological assessment.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to turn this over to Bill Cullum from the Public Health and the lead researcher on the project, should you so choose to allow us to go forward.
That's fine.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bill Cullum, deputy to the state public health officer. We're here seeking permission to apply for a federal grant from the Centers for Disease Control, National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health, otherwise known as NIOSH. This is a collaborative effort between public health, Oregon Occupational Safety and Health, or OSHA, as well as the Plumber, Steam Fitters, and Marine Fitter Local Union 290. This is a grant opportunity to do the feasibility assessment regarding illness and disability experienced by tradesmen in this particular union. In an initial assessment between the three parties that I just mentioned, public health, or OSHA, and the union, concern over the disability and early death of these persons in these trades for exposures to environmental issues is of concern, and this grant opportunity will allow us to see if there is sufficient data to see if an assessment can be done into proactively being able to address from an environmental aspect what is the causes of this. This is a two-year opportunity, approximately $137,000 a year. It does provide the department with a cost allocation mechanism, and the grant is not due until January 6th. This is a federally funded opportunity. The department will not seek any general fund backfill, and if awarded, we would seek limitation, if necessary, at the probably at the April rebalance. Because the grant application wouldn't be due until January, so we wouldn't know if we were successfully awarded, probably at least for 30 days after that. If you have any technical questions regarding the epidemiological aspects of that, I have asked Catherine Thompson here to join me, and she is from our Environmental Occupational Epidemiology. Thank you for your consideration of the grant.
Okay, thank you. So we're talking about an epidemiological assessment that will not require any state funds. And are there any questions from the panel?
My only question is, it doesn't require any state funds. Does it also not require any state positions in order to implement the grant?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, at this point, I believe that we would probably have to review our existing position authority. We would probably need to have a project coordinator named for the grant. And whether or not we would have existing position authority with which to do that, we would need to do an assessment of where we are with staffing at that point. I believe the funds themselves would provide for approximately about 1.5 FTE. The remainder of the funds, of course, we would need to be able to enter into some contractual arrangement with the attending physician that actually does the annual evaluations of the tradesmen in this union.
Okay.
Then I guess I need more information what a project coordinator does.
All right. Could we have information on what a project
because
coordinator is?
I don't see in here the position authority inside of the, in looking at the narrative, Mr. Britton.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Senator Winters. I have received a grant application from them. It's not due until January 6th, so I wouldn't expect them to have it yet. As you know, the Department of Administrative Services could establish a limited duration position or two limited duration positions if necessary, and those would, through the position system, be eliminated at the end of the biennium. They would have to be either reestablished at the beginning of the next biennium if the grant were to continue into the 07-09 biennium.
Okay, so this is a step-by-step process that we're not making final decision on that issue. Senator Gordon.
Thank you very much. Is there a university partner involved in this grant? OHSU comes to mind.
Chair Richardson and Senator Gordley, I'm going to ask Catherine Thompson to address that element because I do believe we do have a connection with Portland State University.
Good morning, Chairman Richardson and members of the panel. My name is Catherine Thompson. I'm an epidemiologist in the Environmental and Occupational Epidemiology Section at the Health Services. We have been in touch with different sections of both Portland State University and Oregon Health and Sciences University. We collaborate with them pretty extensively. In this particular project, we are working with an occupational health psychology professor, Professor Leslie Hammer at Portland State University. She has been working extensively with unions on the balance between stressors at work and in family life. And she is moving forward to do some work with this particular union with some funding that she is applying for currently. So we are trying to dovetail with the university and potentially expand this into a larger project to look at other risks to the population.
Very good. Glad to hear about that link. Thank you.
We could hear from our analysts.
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, I'm Pam Teschner again with Department of Administrative Services, and we recommend that you acknowledge or that you approve this request for the grant application.
Thank you. Mr. Britton?
Mr. Chair, we likewise recommend your approval.
Are there questions of our analysts?
No, just as long as they have to come back for me to know the position authority.
Okay. That's a good place. With that, then we'd accept a motion.
Mr. Chair, I would move that we acknowledge receipt of the grant request.
President Hannah moves that we acknowledge the receipt of the grant request and move it to the full e-board. Is there discussion? Is there objection? Hearing none. It carries. Representative Hannah, would you go ahead and carry on? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
We'll now move to item number 14, which is a report on implementing Medicare Modernization Act.
Mr. Chair.
Stand.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the next piece for your consideration is the we were requested to report to you on an occasional basis where we stand with MMA, and we're prepared to do that if you would be interested in hearing from us.
Okay, since we are on TV and on internet, it's the Medicare Modernization Act. It's the federal prescription drug a change in program that's going to be effective, hopefully, January 1st. And so please.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. And the registration period is opens November 15th and runs for 6 months. And as you may have noticed, a number of insurance companies have entered the market and are advertising for folks to select their plan. And I'm going to introduce or ask her to introduce herself to you, the woman who's running it for the department, and she'll make some general comments about where we stand.
Thank you.
Chairman Richards and members of the committee, my name is Jane Ellen Wydance, and I'm the Department of Human Services.
Say that again, please.
I'm sorry? Jane Ellen Wydance.
Would you spell your last name for me?
W-E-I-D-A-N-Z. And I'm the project manager for the Department of Human Services in implementing the Medicare prescription drug program for the dual eligibles in the state of Oregon. And as the report says, we've done about 30 trainings across the state for both DHS employees, Area Agency on Aging employees, long-term care providers, and volunteers to really get everyone up to speed before the November 15th deadline. As a state agency, we've met all the requirements that the federal government has put before us, and we are on target to meet the rest of their requirements, so we're pretty pleased about that. And we also have plans, aggressive plans in place to help all 54,000 dual-eligible clients that will lose their eligibility come for prescription drug coverage through the state of Oregon on December 31st, 2005. We will be contacting every single one of our dual-eligible clients to help them make an appropriate choice of which prescription drug benefit that will work best for them. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
I do have a question.
Senator Gorley.
Thank you very much, and appreciate all of the efforts that are underway. Could you speak to, with regard to the 30 trainings that have taken place, given some of our challenges historically, reaching underserved populations, can you speak to us about how, through your training, you are acknowledging that challenge? Underserved meaning racial and ethnic populations, folks who are challenged by not speaking English. Again, give us some feeling for how deeply you're going into Oregon communities to make sure that the word gets out.
Sure.
For everyone who will be affected.
Chairman Richardson and Senator Gordley, thank you for the question. The Department of Human Services was directed really to focus on the impact to the dual-eligible clients, but in partnership with the Department of Administrative Services, we are working collaboratively with other programs throughout the state to really reach that population. We have done an extensive work with all of our case managers and our bilingual staff, and are going to continue to work to make sure that those individuals working with our minority populations and our at-risk populations come to those trainings so that they understand both the basics of this prescription drug program, but also what are the impacts and potential negative outcomes if our clients aren't in good plans. Again, and then with that partnership on the larger level, we are working with faith-based communities that work with minority populations, and we are working to develop greater resources in those communities and have a tentative plan at this point to really reach out over the next 6 weeks to that population to get the information to those that can work with that population.
I really appreciate the response, and particularly hearing that there is an emphasis on the faith-based community and developing those partnerships. Thank you.
In so doing, what I'm hearing you say is that although your focus is on dual eligibles, that you are willing and able as the opportunity arises to reach and help those that are not dual eligible but are still elderly and are confused.
Chairman Richardson, with the joint project between all of the state agencies working together, we are doing everything we can to serve all 540,000 Medicare beneficiaries in the state of Oregon. Again, DHS will be focusing primarily on our population, but because of our system being so universal and a one-stop center for many communities across our state, our local offices are definitely feeling the impact from people calling and coming in and asking for general information. And so we are willing and able, and we are partnering with anyone who wants to partner with us, and we have sent out the invitations very broadly to participate with us on a statewide coordination effort so that we can not only do everything we can at the state level but get it down to the local community, to the actual local community centers that can help with people.
Okay, thank you.
Chair Richardson, I would point out that our 54,000 dual eligibles are auto-enrolled, so meaning that they technically don't have to deal with the question as to whether I should, because it will be done for them. There is a question as to whether the right program was selected for them, and we're willing to help with that. But all the outreach that was just discussed is in addition. It's an attempt to deal with the much larger number of folks who are eligible, who are in Oregon and are confronting these issues, and we're trying to make sure that every portion of our staff and the other contacts we have are available to help these folks make the decisions.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions? Senator Gordley.
Do you have any concerns that we should be aware of around how this program is rolling out in our state?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, I would answer that question yes, and I would point out a couple things, if I may. First of all, the advertising that's being put out is November 15th is D-Day, it is suggesting somehow, I frankly think it is scaring some seniors, scaring them into thinking that they have to do this by November 15th. And that's not the correct message. The correct message is that registration starts November 15th. You have 6 months to decide. 3 months after the registration starts, this program begins. And if you haven't made your decision, of course, you would be ineligible for those months that you don't decide. But it's not a question of, you know, these people have to be scared into making a decision by November 15th. I think that's an unfair pressure that's being put on folks for whom some of these questions are tough. And that's one piece, I think. And the other is the selection of plans is something that a lot of seniors are going to need some assistance with. For some folks, this is not this may not be a good idea to register for some. For most, I think it probably will be, but then they need to be careful about what plan they do get into. And one of the messages that isn't out there, I think, strongly enough is that you can change plans. You know, if you get into a plan that is one that isn't to your liking or that works for you, you are eligible to get into something else, to switch. Finally, if you don't register at when you're eligible in the six months elapse, there is a penalty that's attached by the federal government that is unfortunate, and I think, and it needs to be part of the message as well.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Winter.
Because there is so many questions and confusion surrounding Medicare Modernization Act, some of us are having town halls. I'm having one on the 3rd of November in my community, and thankfully Human Services will be with me, as well as some of the folks from the pharmaceutical industry, so you can explain the whole breadth of the issue and assist people in walking through, because it's not as simplistic as everybody would want to think it is. But I want to commend the agency for having trained all these individuals and working with all the groups, because we said early on that it was going to take a cadre, a full army, in order to get this information out and to assist in working with the seniors and people with disabilities in our communities if this was going to work in a very efficient way. And I know that you have, and I know that there's also a lot more work left to be done to make certain that we are not only assisting the person in this choice selection, but also, you're correct, Brian, there's some individuals who don't even have to opt in at this point in time. I mean, there's a lot of still questions, and the information out there is if you're a senior, you've got to do it right now. That really is not accurate. So,
okay. Thank you. Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. After we've completed the amount of training and so forth that we've done with both providers and staff, do we have an indication, or do you feel like you have some indication of the level of additional services necessary? I mean, we talked about this during the session, that as you bring these people in and begin to screen them for their eligibility for additional services, do you have a feeling for where that's going, what the caseload might do in terms of increases to the food stamps and other programs?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanna, I do not at this point have that. That's an interesting question, and I'll ask when I get back to the office as to whether or not we are tracking that and get some information back to you.
Okay. Thank you. Ms. Teschner.
Mr. Chair and members of the subcommittee, I'm Pam Teschner with the Department of Administrative Services, and we ask that you acknowledge receipt of the report.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, we likewise recommend that you acknowledge receipt of this report.
Mr. Chair, I move that we acknowledge receipt of the report.
Senator Winters moves that we receive and acknowledge this report and that we send it on up to the full e-board for their consideration. Is there discussion? Is there objection? Hearing none. Ordered. Senator Winters, would you carry it?
I'd be happy to. Thank you.
Also, Mr. Chair, I need a carrier for the last one on the grant, on the epidemiological grants.
That's Representative Hanna.
Oh, okay.
All right. Thank you. And that concludes your presentation today.
It does, and, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Director Johnson, we want to thank you for your service.
Thank you very much.
And you're handing the baton over to Director Goldberg, but you had a hard job to come in and fill the shoes and be there for the, that's been 4 months, is that right?
It seems longer, but it's been, it's been five and a half months.
Well, thank you very
much.
Thank you. With that, we'll now move into number 15, which is the Insurance Pool Governing Board.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Rocky King. I'm the administrator of the Insurance Pool Governing Board, which is responsible for the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program. I'm going to kind of go through in quick summary of what our request is today and give you some background. And I also have with me Lynn Reed from the Department of Human Services and the Office of Medical Assistance Programs, who will be able to provide us some details on the negotiations and discussions with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, called CMS. If you recall, the 2005 legislature through House Bill 5576 directed the Insurance Pool Governing Board to report to the November Emergency Board on the status of negotiations with CMS regarding the request for flexibility in meeting the FEOP, Family Health Insurance Assistance Program's maintenance of effort requirement, with additional expenditures in either the SCHIP program, the Children's Program through Medicaid, or the OHP Standard Program. Today's report really provides you an update on those negotiations, as well as the context for the deliberations of the special appropriation and request that the emergency board approve option two, which I'll outline in a few minutes. Just for some background, though, if you recall, the legislature approved a reduction in the IPGB budget of $4 million of general fund and created a special SPA account in that amount and directed the emergency board directed the state to pursue an amendment to the OHB 2 waiver agreement with CMS. House Bill 5576 provides the emergency board, if they do not allocate the money based on the negotiations and some of the options we'll outline to DHS, it will be allocated back to the Insurance Pool Governing Board to meet the MOE requirements within FEOP. Currently, the MOE agreement requires that the state expenditures for FEOP over a five-year period be about a little over $40 million. That's based on 2002 state general fund expenditures in the program, which were about $8 million, and the agreement initially made under the OHP 2 waiver was that we would expend that same amount spent when it was a state-funded only program for a period of 5 years. But what we're requesting and what the legislature wanted us to do was to go to CMS and see if there's some flexibility in which programs might meet the FEOP MOE. If CMS permits Oregon to count the other expenditures for some of these options, either in SCHIP or OHP standard, then the emergency board could make a decision to allocate those funds to one of those other programs or to leave a portion or all with FEOP. The timing of the allocation of these SPA is contained within the budget report. I won't go through that. We've pretty much talked about that in a lot of detail. Lynn will, at the end of this report, give you a summary of the three discussions we've had with CMS, which were primarily focused on a variety of options that we gave them to consider counting towards the maintenance of effort requirement. The first of those was to increase the number of adults that could be covered in the OHP standard program. The second was to extend the eligibility period for children enrolled in the state's CHIP program from 6 months to 12 months. The third was to increase the income limit for both children in FEOP and CHIP from the current 185% of federal poverty level to 200%. And finally, the fourth option presented to CMS was to eliminate the current CHIP asset limit of $10,000. And I should say that those were presented in no priority order either to CMS or to you today. Again, in each case, the state is asking for permission from CMS to count expenditures in any of these options towards the state obligation for the FEOP MOE. The agency, or Lynn will update you in a few minutes on those negotiations. In the budget report, you also instructed us to continue to market the FEOP program aggressively with the idea that if we got a no, that we would not be in a position of violating that MOE agreement. And I should say the staff of IPGB and FEOP have been very successful. In fact, we've exceeded what our initial projections were as to where we would be in terms of enrollment at this time. As of September 30, we had about 14,066 enrolled in the program, and as of last night, we had about 14,000. Because of this, this enrollment level is ahead of the agency's projections made during this session, we've actually had to implement the reservation list on October 15. That is, we have a delicate balance between who's enrolled, how many applications are out there, how many applications we have in, and people calling in and asking for those applications. And because we are ahead a little bit in, of our projections, we've reinstituted the reservation list. What that means, if somebody calls up and says, I would like to get an application for your Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, we put them on a list and we tell them that we can only send out an application if and when we're able to have openings within the program. We use that as our management tool to control enrollment over the last 3 or 4 years of the program. Now, there are three options that we've really presented to you today, and there are a lot of variations on those options, and you may want to head some different directions. But let me go through those options very briefly. First option is to take the $4 million in the SPA and allocate it to the Insurance Pool Governing Board at this particular meeting in order to meet the FEOP MOE requirements. Now, this assumes a couple things. One is that we will get to about 16,500 to 17,000 enrollments by January 1, and that beginning at that point, if we were to receive that $4 million and the additional federal funds that go with that, matching funds, we would continue for the remainder of the biennium to keep group market open. We've always said we want to be at about a 50-50 split between group and individual. Right now, it's more like 35%, 65%, 35 being the group. So we want to continue to try to encourage and get group enrollments. And the secondly is they're a good deal for the state, given the employer match. They are the least expensive of all the populations that we serve. However, once we reach that 16,500 to 17,000 level, we would only allow individual enrollments into the program as people dropped off the program. Every month we lose 300, 400 people for a variety of reasons, and we would only fill those first with group, depending on how many group enrollments, and then secondly, if there was room to allow some of those people on the reservation list to enter the program. But we would pretty much keep even for the remainder of the biennium. Option two, and the one that the executive branch is going to recommend, is to await CMS decision for flexibility to use that $4 million general fund for either OHP standard or the SCHIP expenditures to meet the FEOP MOE requirement. Specifically, the first priority of the governor and the executive branch is to allocate those funds to the SCHIP program to expand the eligibility period for children from 6 months to 12 months. Now, if that occurs, there are some ramifications for the FEOP program. We would basically be put into a position of having to hold the enrollments in place and not to allow those that have been approved to enroll, those that have applications in-house to enroll, and those that have received applications but have not sent them to us. We would have to notify them that we wouldn't have room for them in the program. And depending on the attrition rate, there could be a period at the end of the biennium where we might have to disenroll some people. But that's a big if, because it really depends on how long people stay in the program. In all of these assumptions, it's important to note that we would remain open to those people who had group coverage available to them. If CMS denied Oregon's waiver amendment request to be able to use that $4 million in the SGIP program, we would be in a position, though, of having to ramp the program up to the 19 to 20,000 level in order to meet the MOE requirements. And I want to assure you that we can do that. We can bring the program down or move it up based on those management actions. The third option is to fund the FEOP program at the amount required to cover current enrollments and those people that we'll say are in the pipeline, that have been approved, that are out there working with agents or have made application to carriers, those people who have actually provided us with the applications and all the documentation with the hope of getting into the program, and also to include those people who have actually asked us for an application or in process of filling those out and returning those to us. That would be about $2.9 million. We're a little bit above that, but by timing some of these, we would be able to live within that amount. Again, that assumes the group market would continue to be open. We're only talking about some management actions that would impact those that don't have group coverage available to them and must use the individual market. This would result in a peak enrollment of about 16,500 to 17,000 in the January time frame, and through natural attrition would bring us down to somewhere between 12.5 or 13.5 thousand by June 30 of 2007. Again, no new enrollments in the individual market. Through attrition, we would go down there, but we would continue to add folks through the group market. So we're asking basically two things today of you. First of all is to accept the agency's report that's going to come in a minute on the status of the negotiations with CMS regarding the request for additional flexibility in meeting the maintenance of effort requirement. And number two is the executive department recommends that we await the CMS decision for flexibility to use that money. And it would be their intent, if they receive that approval, to come before you and ask that $3.7 million of the SPA be transferred to DHS for the purpose of extending eligibility period from 6 months to 12 months for children eligible for SCHIP. So, Mr. Chair, I'd like to ask Lynn Reed now to give us a report on the negotiations.
Thank you. I'm Lim Reed, Interim Administrator with the Office of Medical Assistance Programs within the Department of Human Services. As Rocky mentioned, we have now had three conference calls with CMS in relation to the request letter we sent to them. And at this point in time, CMS has indicated that they couldn't tell us what their leanings are yet. Their areas of concern are that allowing some of the funds that are earmarked to go towards FEOP maintenance of effort expenditures are precedent setting. If they were to allow those funds to be spent on other programs and still be considered as meeting the maintenance of effort requirements. They said that because it would be precedent setting, that the policy and fiscal issues have to be elevated within their decision-making ladder. And the basic area of concern is that FEOP and its maintenance of effort requirement were approved under what was called a HIPAA waiver, which is a Health Insurance Flexibility and Accountability Act. And those HIPAA waivers are only granted to supplement state-funded only programs that couldn't otherwise be approved through some other waiver process. And those are programs that are focused for the administration's purposes on employer-sponsored insurance options as a primary focus of what they approve under HIPAA waivers. They said that our proposed options that we were seeking flexibility for you on could be implemented through our regular OHP waivers. They wouldn't require a HIPAA waiver. And so that puts a bit of a disconnect for them, and that's why it needs to elevate within their decision-making process to decide whether or not they want to open that door. If they open it for Oregon, they would open it potentially for other states. They said that all of our proposed options are reasonable policy options from a federal perspective. It's just whether or not they want them funded, at least in a maintenance of effort perspective with the HIPAA waivers. We did ask them if there was any of the proposed options that they thought had a stronger chance of securing approval within the CMS system. And one of the individuals said, well, if I had a limb to stand on, the stronger limb would probably be extending eligibility from 185% of the poverty level up to 200% of the poverty level for children in both the FEOP and CHIP programs. They thought that they had a bit of a connection with that one back to the HIPAA waiver approval. When we received approval for the HIPAA waiver, and later received approval to, we actually have federal approval to increase coverage up to 200% of the poverty level. However, we haven't had the funding to do so in-state. But when they gave us that approval, they said that we could not take FEOP to 200% of the poverty level unless we also took CHIP to 200% of the poverty level. And so there may be some connection there that would allow them to open a door, but not too wide a door. However, they didn't rule out any of the proposed options, they saw extending eligibility certification periods for CHIP kids up to 12 months as a substantive policy change and a favorable one. Generally, they do favor enhanced coverage opportunities for kids over adults. We've gone ahead and scheduled another conference call with them for next week, and at that time they want to hear what transpires here in Oregon at the emergency board. They've indicated that a well-defined, narrow proposal from Oregon with a deadline attached could be pushed through their decision-making process in 60 days. We haven't had that type of experience with CMS in the past, but they indicated that we could do so. The discussion really was a bit circular in nature, chicken and egg, which comes first, in that we were asking CMS to tell us what they were open to approving as meeting maintenance of effort requirements. They were saying to us they want Oregon legislative, the legislature, to tell them what it is you want to do before they would then take a position on it. And so from that perspective, any direction that we get that would allow us to carefully craft the request to CMS and then try and push it through a 60-day approval process would be helpful.
Okay. Questions?
Yes.
Senator Gordon.
Thank you very much, and good morning to both of you. I have questions for you, Mr. King and Ms. Reed, that hopefully will help unpack some of the information so that we better understand the implications of making a decision now around the 2.9 million and the implications of waiting until later. And the 60 days that you speak of, is it 60 days running?
It would be 60 days from when we give them that more narrowly crafted proposal. They're on notice that the next emergency board meeting is in January.
All right. Let me pursue these questions with you. I understand that there are 3,516 applications for individual coverage under review. Is that an accurate number?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, currently we have about 4,554 total applications. 3,385 of those are for the individual market. 1,169 of those are for the group market. Now, those are lives. Those are not applications. You would probably, because we deal with lives as opposed to, you know, a family may have 10 people or 4 people, but the cost of 10 people is different than 4. We always deal with what we call lives.
And hearing that distinction and speaking again to the distinction, what number of those applications, the applications that involve people's lives, how many of those applications have actually been approved?
Ms. Chair, Senator Gordley, that's a different figure. Applications under review are those that we've not taken action on. We've just received the application. If you talk about applications that have been approved, that's a different figure, and that would total 4,006, of which 3,123 are individual, 883 are group. Based on actual enrollment factors, and averages over the course of the program, we would expect about 2,600 of those to actually end up enrolling.
Okay.
That takes you to about 17,000 if you count the 2,600 plus the 14,500. Takes you to about 17,000 as a projected enrollment over the next 30 to 90 days.
Can you give me a number of those who have actually been enrolled as of this date?
Sure. 4,740 in the group market, Senator Gordley, and 9,710 in the individual market, and that's a total of 14,450. And this was run at 5 o'clock yesterday.
All right, thank you. And moving on, how much of the budget, the FEOP budget, is spent on marketing, including staff time, travel, materials?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, I don't have the down to how much is staff time here with me today, but I will say that our budget for all the administration of the program was approximately 9%, I believe, of FEOP expenditures. That includes eligibility, outreach, training, office management, policy, booklets. The whole ball of wax is about 9%. And we expect to spend about, as from the administrative side, about 10.25% the first year of the biennium, 8.81% the second half of the biennium, close to that, and it comes out to a little under 9% for the biennium.
I could follow up?
Yes, I would. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. What portion of the $2.9 million will be spent on the marketing activities, as you have just described?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, none. That is pure pure subsidy money, I believe.
Okay.
Yep.
Two additional questions. Maybe there may be three in here. From now until January, are there any of these monies, again, just wanting to clarify for the record, are there any of these monies that would be spent on marketing, including staff time, travel, and materials?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gorley, yes. The directive from the legislature was to do as much outreach and marketing in the group market to bring group enrollments in for the remainder of the biennium. The difference in terms of staff time is that prior to basically in September or latter part of August, early September, we felt we had done enough outreach to generate the applications through the system to meet the MOE requirement. At that point, we shifted, I think it was in the end of August, all of our efforts now, unless we're invited just to speak and do some general information things, but the majority of our efforts of our marketing and outreach folks are in the group market, not the individual market. So they will continue because the expectation is that we continue to build up the group market.
So again, I am hearing then that there is a portion of the money that would be spent on marketing, staff time, travel, in the period October through January.
Ms. Chair, Senator Gordley, not in the 2.9. That is subsidy money that we utilize for people to purchase health insurance. Our administrative money is separate from that $4 million that was set aside in the SPA.
It comes from other money in the budget.
Okay.
And one last question. How many children could be served under the DHS proposal to increase the time of enrollment for kids from 6 months to a year, and what would be the cost of that proposal?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, for one year of coverage with a program fully implemented, the $3.7 million of state funds then matched with federal funds would serve 9,600 children. And that's our estimate of what the uptake would be by moving from 6 months to 12 months.
Very good. Thank you.
Senator Winter.
Mr. Chair, in order to try to get a profile of what, when you said lives, that we deal with lives, can you give us some understanding of what you mean by lives and how many children are involved in the group market, so that we get a clear picture when we're talking about what's happening inside of FEOP?
Ms. Chair, Senator Winters, let me just kind of divide this into three populations by market as opposed by people. The first of all, you have the group market. And we have about 4,740, I think I said, in the group market. Of that, 46% are children. And a little over 70% of those children are in families that earn under 100% of the federal poverty level. So you have, it's pretty much split. It's been as high as 52 and as low as in the 40%, but right now it's about 46% in children. In the individual market, it's a little different, and there's really two distinct populations in the individual market. The first one are what we call the high-risk individuals, people that have serious health conditions, diabetes, cancer, multiple sclerosis, and about of that 9,700 in the individual market currently enrolled, we have a little over 4,000 of those that have serious chronic health conditions. 68% are female, average age is about 50 years old. It's actually median age is 47, but we have 202 very chronically ill children. If you took those 202 out, you'd have about an average age of 50 years old. So that's what we call our high-risk population. They go to the high-risk pool. The premium obviously does not cover the full cost. Chair Richardson's heard the OMIP budgets called OMIP, and carriers through the assessment help participate in the payment for the health care costs of those folks. That leaves us with about 5,000 in the individual market, just straight individual, private coverage. And of those, about 29% are children. So there's children kind of all through this, but there are very, very different populations in terms of average ages, male, female. The higher risk individual market is generally female, older. The group market, you'll see, is generally a younger family market with a spouse and a child or two children covered in the group market. The individual is generally those folks that work for businesses that don't provide group health insurance and aren't eligible because of any health condition for any programs of the state, but just want to cover themselves. Senator Winters?
That's very helpful because, you know, we often think in terms and we talk about this as though somehow children are not involved in a FEOP and it's not a family, and in fact it is. And what we haven't talked about is this high-risk population. And the fact that 68% of that high-risk population are females. My question then becomes, if we don't have this ability for that population, what happens?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, what happens is they show up in emergency rooms just like anybody else that doesn't have health insurance.
You know, this is interesting dynamics because the legislature had the report that you're way behind in the marketing, and so we said, well, we got two concerns. One is we got the MOE. This maintenance of effort has to be dealt with, and we have to assume until we find out otherwise that we're going to have to deal with it the way that it's presently in place, which means that we have a huge amount of increase in funding for FEOP, and it has to be spent to do the maintenance of effort. And so... But on the other hand, we're increasing your budget so drastically from like $48 million for the last biennium to, you know, $75 to $80 million for this current biennium that, we want to withhold $4 million and maybe come back and see whether or not or how you're doing, because maybe we could use that money elsewhere if CMS will agree to it. So now we're finding ourselves in a situation where you have done your job. You have done it extremely well. You've contacted independent businessmen, licensed insurance agents, and they are out marketing this product and to groups and individuals, but individuals are buying into it more than others, and Senator Winters has certainly brought up one of the reasons is that a lot of these people are chronically ill and they can't get coverage elsewhere. They can't afford it. And so now you're in a situation where you're coming in and making a recommendation, or the executive's recommendation, the governor's, that option two be accepted, which is essentially to go back to these agents that have been presented this information, and they've sold policies and obtained applications and so forth, and then the legislature is going to say, well, although we told you that this is a product and we asked you to go ahead and market it, and you've gone out and you've done whatever you need to do to obtain applications, we're going to disavow those applications, and in fact, we may end up disenrolling people that you've signed up. That doesn't sound like that's going to endear the legislature's decision-making process to the people, and it sounds like it's the opposite, that once again, that whole segment of people all across Oregon are going to be saying, what are they doing? They say, sell it, and then we sell it, and then they pull it out from under us. And in many instances, because of the pending apps, what we're saying is, even you spent your time, not only are we going to say don't sell it, but we're going to say we're canceling the apps. The time you've spent is out, you know, it is for nothing, and the commission that you would have earned is not going to get paid, and so we're going to have a direct impact on your income for doing the thing that we asked you to do. And so certainly that's got to make you feel a little uncomfortable. Certainly if I were governor, I'd feel a little uncomfortable with doing that. But on the other hand, you have this increase in funding for FEOP that may not be there in 2 years, and so the $4 million could be used elsewhere. So I see it as a huge dynamic. It's not an easy decision either way. But you've clarified what the situation is, and if there's other questions, we'll take them. If not, we'll hear what our analysts have to say about it before, and then ask further questions. Do you have a question?
I do just have a quick question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. King, the slowdown on the individual list, you said you have implemented that, or that starts November 15th?
No. Mr. Chair, Representative Hannah, we have slowed down any outreach and marketing. Okay. We basically have said, other than, it's kind of what we call passive marketing or passive outreach, which means if somebody asks us to come and speak, we come out and do it, but we're not actively trying to knock on doors with businesses. We are with individuals or community action agencies or Head Start, all those folks. We're only doing that on the group market now.
But the November 15th follow-up, thank you, Mr. Chair, but the November 15th date is when you would no longer take applications for individual?
Ms. Chair, Representative Hanna, I think you're talking about the LFO recommendation, and that would be correct. To implement that recommendation, what we would do would be to notify all those that have applications. We generally have all their names and addresses. We'd notify them and basically say you have two and a half weeks to get your application in. If you don't, you'll go back on the reservation list.
You know, since we've got a difference between what LFO is recommending and what is being recommended, why don't we proceed and get those recommendations, and then we can do a comparison and answer whatever questions we have. So if we could hear from Pam. We're now looking for an analyst report.
What I will do is that I will present my recommendation. Aaron Kelly Seale, the governor's policy advisor, is available if you have specific questions about the governor's priorities and perspective on this.
Okay, thank you.
From my recommendation, being from the Department of Administrative Services, is simply to acknowledge receipt of report, but also asking that you recognize the governor's priority and recommendation if CMS does allow flexibility, is to, as Mr. King has described, this option to extend eligibility from 6 months to 12 months for children who are in the CHIP program. But my recommendation is just to acknowledge receipt of report.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Rick? Mr. Chair, my recommendation is to acknowledge receipt of report, but also to allocate approximately $2.9 million of the $4 million special purpose appropriation to the Insurance Pool Governing Board for the FIOP program. Now, having done that, this would require the Insurance Pool Governing Board or the FIOP program to not accept further individual insurance applications after November 15th. So those that had already received the applications to date, those applications that the agency had already received in-house would be processed. Those that had received applications and had not turned them in yet would be given approximately 2 weeks to get them in. And if they were found eligible and enrolled in a plan, subsidies would start to flow for those particular folks.
Before we go any further, as a courtesy to the governor, is there something that you would like to come forward and say as his representative?
Chair Richardson, members of the committee, my name is Aaron Kelly Seale. I'm the governor's Health and Human Services Policy Advisor. I appreciate the opportunity just to come up. I would start by saying the governor's recommendation was really designed to drive the exact policy discussion that's occurring today in the committee. And the reason that it was as concretely articulated as it is in the letter you have before you is that the agencies, as you can see, both IPGB and DHS, are in a bit of a quandary, and they need some direction about where you're headed. We have FIOP that's been out aggressively marketing and has, as you point out, Chair Richardson, been wildly successful, I think more successful than they'd originally anticipated they would be, in attracting individuals to apply for acceptance to their subsidy in the individual market. And then there is DHS, which is trying to negotiate with our federal partner around some options to present you, and the federal partner is pushing back and saying, actually, we need you to tell us which of those options you're really asking for. That's not ideal, and I understand that, because I think we could then be in a position, we've got four options. They're telling us they'd give us 60 days review at best for each. That puts you in a position of potentially having to wait 240 days going through a process of elimination. And it would have been our preferred conversation with them, I think, for them to say, yeah, we think this is a good idea, and here's the one we think you should ask us to do. But they're not doing that. So the reason, I think, for the governor's recommendation here is to give some certainty to the agencies so that they know how to proceed over the next the remaining months of the biennium as much as possible. We think it's worth waiting 3 months for the CMS decision to progress because of the potential to cover 9,600 more kids through the CHIP program. And I think that, Chair Richardson, you point out a couple of points which I think are reflected in LFO's report around both risk and credibility, and if I may just quickly address each of those. With respect to risk, there is always a risk that we will not receive approval for whatever we apply for with the federal government. We do our best in advance of those applications, I think, to do due diligence and apply for things that make sense. And as you've heard from Lynn Reed, they have told us that our application makes sense. They just are looking for a little bit more detail. But it is true that there's a risk. We think that risk is outweighed, however, by the potential that we could cover more lives through the Children's Health Insurance Program, and we think that purchase is a good value. Children are relatively inexpensive to cover. They get a fully comprehensive benefit through CHIP that includes vision and dental services, which is not included in FEOP. And they also, I think that at on a broader level, I think the governor is just compelled by both the moral and the economic drivers behind covering kids. It's a long-term investment. It pays off. With respect, that isn't to say that we don't recognize that there are kids in the FEOP program. Senator Winters has raised that point. I think that our approach to this issue has been to avoid disenrolling anyone that is in FEOP and leaving that as a very, very, very last resort. The approach that's recommended, however, would have you close the program, and I just want to make sure everybody's clear about what that means, because there are several levels of process that go along with the FEOP program that are different from, I think, some other programs. The first is whether there are applications in circulation, which means that it's just something that is available to you or to an insurance agent to offer to an individual in the state that is uninsured as a potential for them in terms of applying. You've heard from Rocky that when they actually, quote, open their program, what that means is that they make applications available. That does not mean that people actually enroll. So I think it's very clear to make that distinction. Once an application is submitted, they accept the application, which means then that they will be reviewing it in-house. At that point in time, no one is guaranteed admission to the program. We don't know whether they're eligible, and then we don't even know whether they will choose to enroll. And so after an application is submitted to FEOP and it's reviewed in-house, it then goes back to the individual to say whether they are approved or not approved for enrollment in the program. If they are approved, that individual then has yet another decision to make, and that is whether they will enroll, and they have to take the action upon themselves to enroll in a plan. At that point in time, it's my understanding, and Rocky can correct me if I'm wrong, that's when the issue of commissions with insurance agents really becomes relevant. And so there are several steps in this process, and the governor's recommendation, which would have the e-board defer a decision and hold an amount in the special purpose appropriation significant enough to purchase coverage for CHIP by through the extension of eligibility from 6 to 12 months, that would require two things. First, as you heard already, FEOP is no longer circulating applications, they are now informing individuals who call with an interest in the program that their name will be put on a wait list and they will be informed when the program, quote, reopens. The first action, though, that they would need to take immediately is not to accept the applications that are in circulation. So if someone chose to actually apply, that application presumably would be received, and the agency would say, I'm sorry, our program is currently closed for enrollment. The second action that they would need to take almost immediately to make sure that they are able to manage their budget is they would need to stop reviewing the applications they have in-house. Those individuals who've applied, as I said, have no guarantee that they would be eligible if that determination hasn't yet been made, nor do we as a state have any indication as to whether they would most certainly choose to enroll if they are approved. So the two actions would be to no longer accept the applications that have been in circulation and to discontinue review of those that are sitting over in the FEOP office today.
There's a kind of a violation of good faith in the fact that it was presented to them, it was explained how it worked, they were asked to fill out an application, and they've submitted the application, and then the state comes forward and says, sorry, we're withdrawing the program?
I appreciate that perspective. I think, however, this program has always been one that operates within a budget box, and so the potential has always been there that there would not be slots available for individuals to enroll in the program. And it will continue to be there, irrespective of the action that the emergency board takes today. I think that that is always the case for Iraqi. He's done a commendable job of making sure that his program balances to the budget that he's given, and he does that using several management tools available to him, the primary one being attrition naturally out of the program.
Okay. All right. Thank you. I'd like to have us ask any questions we have regarding the analysts or anything that's been discussed thus far.
I have a question of the of our analyst, and that is, in coming up with the dollar figure, did you consider that figure based on how much commission was necessary and would be needed to go forward? How was the basis of making your determination of the 2.9?
Mr. Chair and Senator Winters, I asked the Insurance Pool Governing Board to determine the numbers based on the enrollment rates and historic enrollment rates. I don't believe that, well, I certainly didn't consider insurance commissions based on that. And I don't think you did any. Yeah, the analyst for the IPGB is saying no. But the rationale for the November 15th date, as opposed to, for example, of the October 31st date, was to give people who had received applications already an opportunity, a two-week opportunity to get them in.
Mr. Chair, I share your comments and your concern, and I'm very much on the page of having wanted to expand CHIP for children. You know, I think we worked on that last session, and we worked on it this session. But I think it is a conundrum because we also have said to an agency that we want you to go out, we want you to be aggressive, we want you to do certain things, and then we come back and we said, oops, all those applications that you went out there and you obtained from the citizens, now suddenly we're going to change our course of action. I think that puts us in a place of, I wrote down here, that it's an integrity issue. As I sit here thinking about the decisions that we make and the direction, policy direction that we give agencies, and then when we too don't follow through on what we've asked them to do, it's very questionable in my mind of how, as you sit there rocking, and we've told you to do certain things, and then now you may or may you've done what we've asked you.
No, that's really true, and we all support children, and we all know that CHIP is a good program. And the question we're really dealing with is, when does the program get put on hold? Does it get put on hold? You've already stopped actively enrolling, but if an application came in yesterday, you know, you still would be processing it. Do we wait? Do we put on hold effective today and just say anything that's in the works is out, which is this integrity issue, and I believe there is a violation of good faith to people that sell the policies, to people that signed up, people that have hopes, you know, to for us now to say we created the project or the program and we have the ability to say there's not enough funding, and even though we've led you to believe that you could be in this process, we're cutting it off. That's one. One would be to say, okay, we're going to take that position, but essentially it's going to be effective October 31st. The recommendation from LFO, which has been considered with leadership in both houses, is that we look at November 15th as the date which allows those things that are in the works to be cut off at that point. And then of course, the other option is that we just go ahead and fund it. So I guess we can't underestimate the fact that we are in this dilemma. And the recommendation from LFO is that if there's been representations made to people by the legislature that this program is in place and it's been in process, and your agency and your people have been very successful, Mr. King, in going out and instructing and helping brokers understand how to sell the policies and those kinds of things, and everybody so far has been acting on what you've said, the recommendation is that we have to kind of split this $4 million in a way, 3.7, and say we're going to honor what's been done to this point, but we're going to draw a line. We're going to take a rest period. We're going to take a time out starting November 15th for at least 3 months, and hopefully at the end, or sometime in that period of time, we'll know where CMS is going to be, because if CMS comes back and says, no, we don't want the precedent this sets for other states, and while it may make sense here and it's not a lot of money, the precedent could be expanded in a large state very easily, then you are in a position to go out and sell the rest, you know, utilize the rest for the maintenance of effort, which is the underlying factor in this whole amount of funding that that FEOP has received for this biennium. And that would be easier to do than if we say we're going to cut it now and then go to the brokers and everyone that's been involved and say, sorry, we have the ability to say no, and so we're stopping, with the risk that if CMS says no, then we're going to go back to those same people and say, well, we'd like to turn the faucet back on again, and even though we pulled the rug out from under you last time, we want you to stand up and go out and sell these again. And so the credibility issue can have long-term consequences, and it's not an easy decision. Is that basically how you see it, Rocky? I mean, are these the considerations? Are we analyzing this right from your viewpoint?
Well, Mr. Chair, this is tough question. I mean, the governor, I think, has clearly stated what his policy is in terms of trying to expand services to children. And there's no win-win here. I mean, there are people on both sides of this equation. We will do what you want us to do. And there are a lot of grown-up adults out there that are working in the SGIP program and our programs. And we'll carry out the policies. If you tell us to close it, we'll close it. We'll explain it. We'll work with them. We can do that. You raise a lot of issues, but we're really just prepared to kind of take your direction at this point. We support the governor's initiative to try to expand coverage to as many children as we can.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, if I may, just for one moment, just point out another dynamic. I think you've captured the others very, very well, but I just want to remind the committee of how this discussion, what, in fact, I think originated this discussion at the legislature, which is even the broader policy issue, and that has to do with uninsurance in our state and the vulnerable individuals that are out there who are not covered, and the best use, most effective use of the dollars. We have our general fund dollars available to maximize our ability to serve those hundreds of thousands of individuals. You know, over 600,000 people in Oregon don't have health insurance today. 100,000 of those are kids. 40% of those kids are eligible but not enrolled in our CHIP program. I think that was the conversation that started, and I just want to make sure it's part of the thinking as you go into this. The goal of setting the money aside to even explore alternative options was to make sure, I believe, as in listening to the testimony, although I wasn't in the building, listening to tapes, the goal was to make sure the state was able to spend the dollars on people who are most vulnerable and most in need. Now, these are all vulnerable people, and so that makes this conversation very difficult. It's not as though the folks who are in FEOP are of significantly higher incomes than the kids that are eligible for CHIP. They're all under the same income level. The breakdown is different in each program, of course. But I think it's just important to remember that the goal originally was to make sure that this $4 million was being spent in the best way possible for those vulnerable folks.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate everybody's input on this. We have different pools of needy people, and the CHIP policies that have been sold are addressing one group, but not focusing on another. The underlying issue is availability of coverage and medical care for the people of Oregon. And we need affordable, available, and high-quality medical care for all people in Oregon. And the real question, and everybody agrees with that, is how do we do that? Do we do a private model? Do we do with a public model? Do we use Canadian? Do we go to an American model, which is some kind of a hybrid? Do we look at what's going on in Florida, what's going on in Maine? I mean, there are different approaches to it, and Oregon needs a policy and a vision working toward a solution for this problem, but we can't do that here today. Today we can only deal with this one issue, and LFO has made a recommendation that we not pull the rug out from under those that have been involved in the process that FEOP has marketed, but that we let them know that as of November 15th, we're taking a breather period for a period of time until we know what's going to happen with CMS, that if we do this approach, then it's going to cost $2.9 million for FEOP, and it reserves $1.1 million for ultimate decision after we know what's going on with CMS. With that, have we ventilated it? Nothing. What do you think, Senator Gordon?
Mr. Chair, I believe I'm prepared to support the LFO recommendation, but I would like to get onto the record some additional comments from some folks who are with us this morning who carry advocacy roles. So I think it's always important to draw out that voice. Mm-hmm. And so I would ask that we invite forward.
Senator, I'm not prepared to do that because I've been contacted by at least 10 different groups.
Mm-hmm.
And so the concern is that if we go into that, then who do we choose and who do we not choose? So with all due respect, I'd prefer not to go into that open unless there's a compelling reason to start that litany.
The compelling reason for me is always that there is a public voice and a voice of representing advocates who are partners. They're always partners with us in this public policy-making process. And I do put the emphasis on public. And I know that we have a certain amount of time scheduled, and I respect that. But again, I think our process is more fully informed when we take the time to listen thoughtfully and completely to all of the partners who can help us make the best public policy decision that will affect so many Oregonians. And I have three people in mind that I would like to ask to, through the chair, to come forward and share briefly on the record
Senator
their comments.
I really, with all due respect, would prefer not to open this into that forum, because although these three would be excellent, there are many others that would like to that have not been given that opportunity, would not be able to. I would rather have us proceed. We've gotten the recommendation. We know what the issues are, and I would like to move ahead without opening it to a public meeting. Any further?
You are the chair, and we will go forward with that understanding, and I'm registering an objection to
okay.
our process.
No, I understand. I mean, it's we've been here for 3.5 hours, almost 3.5 hours, and I think that we know what the issues are, and we've all been lobbied very strenuously by many, many people on both sides of this issue, and this is not an easy one for us to determine, but we need to make a decision and move on, and I don't feel that that going into that realm is going to enable it to be an easier decision to be made. And so, with all due respect, I would like to go ahead and take a motion on LFO's recommendation on this based on all the information that we've received at this point. Is there any that would be willing to make that motion?
Mr. Chair, I move the LFO recommendation.
Thank you. Senator Gordley moves the LFO recommendation that we acknowledge the report, receipt of the report, and
Mr. Chair, it's to allocate $2,910,293 of the special purpose appropriation to the Insurance Pool Governing Board. They're now called the Office of Private Health Partnerships for the FEOP program.
Okay. So the motion is that we accept the FEOP the report on CMS negotiations and the LFO recommendation of $2.9 million for FEOP costs and reserve $1.1 million for DHS and CHIP until the next e-board?
Well, Mr. Chair, the remaining $1.1 million would just simply stay in the special purpose appropriation. And then it could be allocated to DHS, depending on CMS's decision, or it could be allocated to FEOP or a portion thereof.
All right. Thank you. Is there discussion on the motion? Is there objection to the motion? Not. Motion carries. Thank you very much. It's not an easy thing. We appreciate all that you're doing, and we know the difficult position that you're in. You've done a fine job in taking the recommendation that the legislature had to actively market And now we need a breather. That'll take place as of November 15th.
Mr. Chair, do you want to carry that one?
I'll carry that one.
Mr. Chair, before we adjourn, you did make the comment that I just want to expand a little bit on, which is very accurate, and that the issue really is the health care system in Oregon. Last year, I hosted the health care summit. I will be doing another one in December because we must get our arms around. We must come up with some better policy decisions with which to address this issue for all Oregonians. We do have some critical decisions that need to be made. You know, I said there are those of us who really do support the expansion of CHIP. There are those of us who want a health care system so that we don't have a high level of uninsured that we have in this state. And so I think these are policy discussions not only that this body needs to have, but our private partners out there. Who need to be at the table with us to talk about how do we build and develop a health care system in the state of Oregon that addresses the health care needs. That's both from the standpoint of access as well as the standpoint of affordability. And this is not an issue that is unique to any one person sitting up here or in that audience. It's an issue that I think that all of us need to put on our thinking caps. We need to think about how we're going to address the needs of health care for citizens in the state of Oregon. And I do believe that it's beyond just talking about the Oregon Health Plan. I think it's talking about health care in a way of a healthy society here in this state, and it includes docs and everybody. We have taken bits and pieces of this system, and we go at it with bits and pieces rather than going at it at a high level of saying, what is it that we want in this state? I think this conversation today points out the conflicts when we take a piece over here, and then we say, well, but what about the piece over here? And so we're not really getting at the overarching, in my estimation, to take us to a solution. How do we make certain that kids and families have health care in the state of Oregon? How are we making certain that we're not impacting our emergency rooms? Because the fact we talked today, had we made one decision of where you don't have a person, they end up in the hospital emergency room. So I think we've got a lot to talk about before 07, mm-hmm. and hopefully in 07 that we can put together some form around some of these discussions that we're having that come up and really be prepared the next session. That's just my hope.
The citizens deserve it. The people deserve this kind of discussion and vision and a plan that we can agree on. It's not a partisan issue. It's an Oregonian issue. And we have an employer-based plan presently. I read recently that every car made in America carries between $1,400 and $1,500 of the price tag just for medical care, and other countries don't have that same burden. For us to be competitive, we have to look at these issues from all aspects, from the recipient, from the providers, from the payer, who's going to pay, and we must have that. I think it'll be one of the key issues for the next legislative session because people have waited long enough for us
to resolve. What we haven't talked about, the economies, is how it all fits in employment. I've always submitted that if a family has the ability to earn a good, decent wage, they then don't need all of our social services.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you all for your presence and participation and all that we're here today. With that, subcommittee is adjourned.